in Beijing, and I'm very happy to see some of our new graduates, our new alumni, here at their first LSE event in China with that new status. Now, the theme for this year's annual conference is Society and Markets, Achieving Economic and Social Well-being. Since the 2011 LSE China conference, the large divergence in economic fortunes between East and West has largely continued, perhaps even deepened. However, of course, there's rapid development in countries like China and Brazil, to a faltering extent perhaps also in India, begins to hit some of the buffers of inflation and overcapacity. There's clearly a need for all of us to take stock of the role of our economies in the global marketplace. This evening, we attempt to consider some of these issues with our first panel looking at historical development models and what they might tell us in terms of thinking about future economic development. The second panel takes, I'm told, a fairly eclectic look at sharing and managing the benefits of economic growth in modern societies. Before that, though, for our keynote speech this evening, I'm truly delighted to have with us Mr. Jin Li Chun, the chairman of the Board of Supervisors of the China Investment Corporation. Chairman Jin, as many of you will know, has had a long and distinguished career in finance and banking. Prior to his appointment at the China Investment Corporation, he served as the Vice President of the Asian Development Bank. Before joining the ADB in August 2003, he served as Deputy Minister of Finance of China. He's also been the Director General of the World Bank Department at the Ministry of Finance here, and was a member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the People's Bank of China. As well as being Chairman of the China Investment Corporation, Mr. Jin also currently serves as Chair of the International Forum of Sovereign Wealth Funds. Ladies and gentlemen, please join with me in welcoming Mr. Jin Li Chun.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Congratulations on everybody who has graduation today. And I understand graduation means commencement of your new life, your career. I wish you all the best. I did not have your privilege to be educated in LSE. My generation was one of, I would say, generation of suffering. During the Cultural Revolution, when we were in the prime of our life, we didn't have very good time to study, to learn. And then we went down to the rural China. I stayed on the farm for 10 years, for a good 10 years, before I got a chance to be enrolled in the graduate program when our great leader Deng Xiaoping relaunched the college education. I missed a very good part of my life where I could have learned more. But fortunately, I stayed at the grassroots level. I kept touch with the rural people, and I came to know better the Chinese actual situations. I came to know better the sentiment, the ambitions, emotions of the Chinese people at a grassroots level. That paved the way for my career in ensuing three decades. But anyway, I'm very much happy to be associated with LAC because I was invited to speak in a conference organized by Danny in LAC for Sovereign Wealth Funds 2 years ago, and I enjoyed it immensely. Tonight, I am very much privileged and honored to be invited to address this conference organized by LSE, which is really a household name in China. You know, LSE is considered the cradle of distinguished scholars in political science and economics, also distinguished leaders, eminent leaders or business leaders, both in Western countries and also in China. We in China have quite a number of senior leaders who had kind of training in LSE. So they would all say proudly, you know, I had some time in LSE, if not the four-year program, undergraduate program, or finish their PhD. So I hope events like this would be held in China as often as possible, and you are always welcome. Now, tonight, I'm trying to share with you my observations on a couple of issues, hot issues, we could say. The first, the Chinese economy, its performance and growth trend, and the macroeconomic policies adopted by the government in sustaining growth. I'm going to say a few words about euro crisis. And finally, I will discuss my business, which is sovereign wealth funds, and their role in sustaining the global growth and stabilizing international finance. I will give you some time for questions after my speech, about roughly 30 minutes. And you are free to raise any questions you like. For me, no question is off limit. No question is sensitive. But whether I can answer your question satisfactorily, it's up to you to decide. I don't guarantee the quality of my answers, okay? So, first of all, I would discuss the Chinese economy. Concern over China's slowdown has been explicitly pronounced by China watchers, both at home and abroad. Data from the Official Statistics Bureau and interpretation of the data by analysts point to the downward trend of the Chinese economy. How should we look at the numbers of the Chinese economy? The growth rate of 7.6% in quarter two and 7.8% in the first 6 months did indicate the slowing down of the Chinese economy. But this should not be the cause for alarm, in my view. As a matter of fact, 7.8% growth is quite decent, given the tough global situation. China compares favorably with other BRIC countries by the data of the British company consensus. India and Russia, for instance, grow at about 5% in Q2, in quarter two. Brazil, around 1.2%, and South Africa registered moderate growth as well. The figures for advanced economies are even less encouraging. Preliminary data shows that the Eurozone slid into negative territory of minus 0.3% in quarter two, while the US economy has slowed to 1.6%. On the whole, for the emerging economies, the cyclical slowdown can be addressed with relative ease. But longer-term erosion of potential growth of the global economy is much tougher to handle. We should be prepared for that. The IMF still reckons that developing economies will grow by 5.6% this year, which indicates positive dynamics for the bloc. But still, the outside world watches China with a bit of concern, as this economy's performance has huge implications for Asia and other emerging market economies, one way or another. As I see it, Given the growth rate of the first two quarters, the Chinese economy performance is fairly good. What's worrisome is not the data for the first two quarters, it's the trend. Whether Chinese economy will have a hard landing or will continue to slow down below, let's say, 7%. The general impression is that the slowdown has a lot more to do with macroeconomic policies and less with the normal business cycle. As people, some of the analysts point to the very aggressive policies implemented by the government in the previous year. Bringing down the growth rate to less than 8% was the policy laid down by the government, as announced by Premier Wen Jiabao in his report to the National People's Congress in March this year. So what's the worry? Growth at 8% has always been regarded sacrosanct, as it is considered critical for the economy's capacity to absorb new labor force into the economy every year. So 8 is not just a lucky number we Chinese embrace. It happens to be the number which tells us the economy could be good enough to create jobs for the young people. Indeed, the government has crossed the psychological Rubicon in making the decision of bringing the growth rate down to 7.5%, below 8. Tight monetary policy through a succession of RRR hikes and interest rate hikes implemented in 2011 did take much of the steam out of the growth engine of the economy, and tough measures adopted to dampen the fever of speculation on property market did make a noticeable dent in the property market. Obviously, the government is arguably the driving force which determines the direction and speed of the Chinese economy. If not elsewhere, it's definitely true in the case of China. It's argued that any aggressive policy is likely to overshoot unless timely adjustment is made to reverse the trend caused by such kind of policies. That is why Premier Wen Jiabao gave instructions to the governmental institutions concerned for preemptive actions and fine-tuning of the macroeconomic policies. As you may know, a set of policies are now put in place to neutralize the impact of the aggressive policies implemented in previous year to reining inflation and fast growth. At present, Eurozone debt crisis and consequential pressure on the global economy constitute the major challenge to China. Increased integration into the global economy implies China's inherent vulnerability to external shocks. Paradoxically, China's strong economic performance over the decades has intensified its vulnerability, as the growth comes from export to a great extent. Efforts to shift the growth pattern have not been very successful, I'm sorry to say that. When the global market continues to take products churned out from the assembly lines in plants in China, the incentive to do anything which could shift the growth pattern will not be very strong. When life is comfortable, it is hard to have people change, and it's very hard to have people convinced of the need to change. Let us take a look at the international trade situation faced by China in the first 6 months of 2012, and we will understand why it's increasingly important for China to really consider the growth patterns shifting. China's trade with European Union and Japan in terms of traditional goods has virtually zero increase. During this period, China's import and export with the European Union registered $267.82 billion, a paltry increase of 0.7%. China's import and export with Japan was $162 billion, or minus 0.2%. Trade with the United States is a bit better, an increase of 11.9% in amounts of $231 billion. What does all this figure tell us? We all know Japan, Europe, and the United States represent the major export markets for China, accounting for 42.1% of China's export. The trade volume with these countries went down by 1.1 percentage points. This is the external situation faced by China. Over the last couple of years, China's export increased by more than 20% on an annual basis, 20%. As a contrast, our export registered $954 billion for the first 6 months, a mere increase of 9.2%. 9.2% versus 20% in the previous years. Given the existing economic structure, for a reduction of 7% in export growth, there will be a reduction of 1 percentage point in China's GDP. So while China's export to Russia, South Africa, and other countries have outpaced the overall growth rate of our export, it is not enough to offset the decline in export to the main traditional markets. We in China did try to stimulate the shifting of the growth pattern, but efforts discontinued by and large owing to the quick rebound of the East Asian economies when it reopened its trade market for China, because the Asian countries rebounded too fast, contrary to the expectations of many people in the world. And then life became more comfortable for China. And the momentum towards the direction had barely built up before it quickly dissipated. The financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 reawakened an urge to do that again. But the exports did not suffer that much after a big drop right after the outbreak of the crisis. And a stimulus program kept economy going full steam without much of restructuring. So, there's a lesson for us to learn. I think it is high time that China took it more seriously in growth pattern shifting. We should be aware of the fact that Eurozone troubles were dragged on for an extended period of time, and trade frictions with the United States will be a perennial issue. Furthermore, an increasing number of emerging market economies and those at a lower level of development will be posing a great challenge to China in competing for the world market. In particular, China's labor competitiveness will not prevail as comfortably as it did over the previous decades. It should be pointed out that shifting the growth pattern does not amount to giving up the export market. In a globalized economy, international trade is always important. For China, it's an issue of how to move up on the value chain. If the world market craves China's high-end products as a rare earth, or if the Western countries embrace China's high-end manufactured goods and the wealthy Chinese embrace the European luxury goods, there's no fear of anti-dumping cases. There's no fear of any trade disputes. Creativeness, innovativeness, and competitive edge at the high-end products will be key to China's continued strong performance in the future. In this connection, a managed slowdown of 7 to 8% will work in favor of the economic restructuring. Shift economic growth pattern and propel technological upgrading through more efficient allocation of resources. Up to a certain point, the slowdown of the economy is intentional. However, reduced growth rate does not automatically translate into economic rebalancing and restructuring. A lot more remains to be done to stimulate domestic demands and reduce dependence on export. The outside world watches with envy the power of the Chinese government in addressing the daunting challenge posed by the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. Now, China pessimists wonder whether the macroeconomic policies will work under the current circumstances. Pessimists outside China have doubts about the Chinese government's ability to address the downward drift of the economy. If the government does not apply the same strategy as it did right after the crisis of 2008 or 2009, what instruments are there in their toolkit? And will these tools work? That's definitely the question on the minds of China watchers. What is happening in Eurozone indicates the difficulty and the limitations of any policy by the government in managing the economy. In some cases, the government seems powerless in achieving their objectives, either containing inflation, reducing debt, or boost growth. In this regard, perhaps an emerging market economy is a better place for the macroeconomic policies to work, only on two conditions. One is relatively low inflation, and the other is low public debt. There is a distinction, in my view, between mature and advanced economy and an emerging market economy. The potency of the macro policies is determined to a great extent by the actual situations of an economy. Biological reaction to a drug varies from person to person. Response to stimulus varies from economy to economy. Policies based on Keynes theories worked effectively, wonderfully, in the post-war Europe and United States, but probably not so well today. In sharp contrast, an emerging market economy, monetary and fiscal expansionary policies could be applied with a better chance of success. In China, the stimulus programs adopted by the government in the wake of the crisis of 2008 and 2009 quickly took effect in neutralizing the downward drift and sustain the economy, because China has a huge backlog of infrastructure projects, and fiscal space is ample enough to accommodate expansionary policies without creating debt problems. This is a luxury many Eurozone members do not enjoy. Quite naturally, a macroeconomic policy is a double-bladed sword. It cuts both ways. The stimulus program gave rise to a mushrooming of infrastructure projects and a booming of the property market, of which quite a lot were financed by the proceeds of the debt incurred by the local governments. The challenge faced by the Chinese government at this moment is to hold the momentum of contraction and sustain the growth at a proper level. At present, the consensus in the leadership and among the economists and analysts is unqualified. Actions must be taken to reverse the trend. The stimulus programs implemented in the wake of the crisis of 2008 and 2009 is not to be repeated this time around. Now, the government is going all out to stabilize growth. We have reason to be confident that growth will not further slow down with the actions taken in the following areas. Perhaps you have noticed that NDRC, which is National Development and Reform Commission, has released a number of projects in the pipeline. Probably you have noticed it has approved a 70 billion yuan steel project in some place and the Guangdong province. And the banking sector has been more accommodating in providing credit lines to some of the sectors like railways and the public housing projects. But I have to point out a difference this time around. The projects which had been waiting, in the pipeline for approval and finally got the release are most of them projects which are related to the 7 emerging industries singled out in the 12th five-year program to support China's economic restructuring, including, for instance, alternative energy, biotechnology, new information technology, high-end equipment, manufacturing, advanced materials, alternative fuel vehicles, and energy conservation and green technology. Projects are screened and approved based on their contribution to the Chinese economy. Not just numbers of GDP, but the long-term restructuring. This is the difference between the stimulus package we adopted 3 years ago and stimulus, to a certain extent, we are doing today. And also, the banking sector is providing financing to help the project sponsors to get jobs done, to get the projects which were financed under the stimulus package 3 years ago. To get these projects done is important for the economy and for the banks as well. You may have noticed that we still need vast infrastructure projects in hinterland provinces. If you tour the western part of China, you would feel acutely of the urgency of developing infrastructure, which is crucial for poverty reduction and improving the living standard of the people over there to strengthen the national harmony. But here, I think we must be very much careful. It's not advisable to put money in a huge infrastructure project in a no man's land. Or you have to wait for many years to see the traffic can move at a reasonable volume. Some people say infrastructure is important. I agree. But still, there is waste in infrastructure investment if you don't do it well. If you develop some power generation plants, you have to match the power generation plants with the transmission lines, and distribution. Otherwise, you will have waste. So roads, railways, airports, ports, all these kind of projects must be coordinated. And development program must be calibrated in such a way that we can use the resources most efficiently and effectively. So balanced development between different localities require that a national overview of the projects under consideration to be taken to ensure that these projects financed by the resources would be reinforcing each other rather than canceling each other out. You may have learned that Chinese government has put in a lot of efforts to provide affordable housing. The social housing project is important for the lower income people. The government has reaffirmed on many occasions that support for affordable social housing projects will be strengthened, whereas policies will remain firmly in place to curb speculative investment in property market. So this is another important area for us to keep the economy going by investing affordable housing, at the same time dampen the fever of speculation on the properties market. I don't want to take too much of your time listing all these kind of things, but I want to highlight a couple of issues. First, when we talk about stimulating domestic consumption, it should be noted that investment is still important for growth. Consumption is fundamentally based on production. To a great extent, demand is created and stimulated by supply. Supply induces demand, but in the first instance, effective supply of products and services which meets the needs of the market calls for investment. Mentioning investment in China will quickly conjure up images of bulldozers and cranes on the construction site. China needs investment of a different kind. Reform in the VAT regime, for instance, will encourage investment in high-tech and service-related sectors. Secondly, financial sector reform has two objectives. One is to strengthen the financial sector and ensure the smooth functioning of the system. The other is to promote better allocation resources for economic growth. Regulatory measures taken by the central bank, such as rolling back the entry barrier to private financial institutions and easing of the monetary policy through lowering RRR and interest rate cuts, will definitely contribute to the stable and steady growth of Chinese economy. In particular, I like to highlight the point that encouraging private capital to go to the financial sector will make it easier for the SMEs to have better access to financing and thus creating more jobs and more demand. The Chinese government has taken aggressive yet cautious steps to steer and manage a decelerating economic growth. I think that efforts in this regard have a long-term impact on the Chinese economy, not just a momentary jolt. We have always talked about how to make the major banks providing financing for SMEs. In my view, this is not realistic. A major bank, the four major banks, are not supposed to provide adequate financing for SMEs. It's too costly and too risky. But if we could have more private financial institutions who are deeply embedded in the local culture and the community, would have a better chance of success in providing financing for the SMEs. And we have empirical evidence to indicate that smaller banks working in the locals are far more efficient and effective in providing financing for the SMEs. Third, keeping a strong fiscal position is key. Not because I came from Ministry of Finance. I always believe we need a strong fiscal position, particularly in a developing country. Look at the deplorable situations in Eurozone. In Eurozone, you know, every dollar which is debt is external debt, not in domestic debt, because they cannot print money on their own. Okay. So if you have a very strong fiscal position, you have much room for maneuver. China has enjoyed ample fiscal space over the years since the taxation reform introduced more than a decade ago. There has been some complaint that MOF has collected just too much tax. When the public saw fast growth rise of the tax revenues in recent years, tax structures could be adjusted in the future, and tax burden could be better balanced. There's always room for improvement, but overtaxing is not really the problems in China. Chinese government does not overtax. The Chinese government assumes far more responsibility than the governments of the Western countries. People may argue that China should also have a smaller government and thus reduce the administrative cost. A great idea. Perhaps it's not realistic at this moment. For me, I have always found the same people who cry for smaller governments will expect the government to take care of them whenever they think they need it. This is typical ambivalence towards the government. In my opinion, as long as the government is more transparent in public spending and use the public resources more efficiently, the complaints will be less vociferous. Moving forward, I would expect the Chinese government will have a new challenge. The government will find it increasingly more difficult to exercise its power to move up or down the market. The broad-based participation of the Chinese people in decision-making through, for instance, the twin conferences, through their blogs and micro-twitters, and other means of modern communication, they would definitely render it tougher for the government to balance the long-term objectives with the short-term objectives of a particular set of policies, and it will be harder to balance the interests of different social segments and pressure groups. This is probably the trend with both its positive and negative consequences. I will be very brief on the Eurozone crisis because I've contributed some columns to some of the English newspapers here in China, and I just want to be very brief. In my view, European countries, particularly Eurozone countries, need leadership. And they need to think in terms of the broad interests of Eurozone rather than in their own sovereign nations' interests. Mr. Draghi's recent adamant statement that ECB will do whatever it takes to preserve euro is very encouraging. But I also understand the ECB will have to do something effectively to show that it's really underpinning the European Eurozone economy. For instance, at the latest ECB meeting on August 2nd, the ECB announced a new round of bond buying to drive down Spanish and Italian borrowing costs and said it would consider other non-standard measures to rein in the Eurozone crisis, hinting at steps that amount to quantitative easing. I believe that there are more positive signs indicating the irreversibility of euro than otherwise. Few people want to see euro's collapse because it serves nobody's interests. Should the euro fail, it would take a devastating toll of the global economy, and already sputtering global recovery will fall by the wayside. So I propose some of the ideas. There should be a master plan for the debt reduction. Sovereign governments must not be quagmired in political debate. Piecemeal measures will make the matter worse. You know, some people say kicking the can down the road is not going to work. Actually, in my home province, we have a saying which is even more funny. Said, wiping the mud off your carrot just that much for the next bite. The carrot is that long, so you wipe just a little bit mud. How many bites? How many bites the carrot would last? But don't imagine you have a long way to go kicking the can down the road. It might be a dead alley. So just think about the carrot. It won't last too long. Eurozone needs growth. During my recent meeting with the European Parliament, I was really shocked to hear a Parliament member who sat next to me, and he said, "What do you talk about growth? We don't need growth. We European countries don't need growth. We are not emerging market countries like China." And, I'm a Chinese. Chinese are typically polite. So I say nothing. And then after he finished speaking, I whispered into his ears, Mr. Something, you know, when you have unemployment rate at 50% for the young people, 25% on a nation, you must be worried about growth. He said, oh, is that true? Forget it. I didn't fabricate it. I didn't make it up. It was true, right? So I was surprised to see how could it be that the European politicians are so detached from their own people, so detached from their reality. If you have money, if you have social status, you enjoy your life in a beautiful villa, in a very quiet area, you certainly hate development, that's for sure. Now, I would like to say a few words about sovereign wealth funds, because I'm with CIC. Sovereign wealth funds have existed for many decades, but before the crisis broke out, few people have noticed SWF's existence. And particularly after CIC, China Investment Corporation, came into being, we seem to be in the limelight. And I remember I was in a meeting talking about sovereign wealth funds. And they said, I don't understand why people are so worried about sovereign wealth funds. There's some very good friends of mine who could be quite frank with me from the Middle East country said, Mr. Jing, it's because of you. You know, we've been here for 60 years, nobody raised any question. Because you, China, came into being, all of a sudden people worried about sovereign wealth funds. It's your fault. I'm sorry. Oh, I understand. Anything related to China might be a cause for alarm. But just relaxed. We will be doing everything possible to help sustain your economy, your development, by winning the benefit for both sides. To use the typical term, we say win-win situation. Thank you so much. I've taken too much of time. I'm sorry about that.
Chairman Jin has very kindly said that he will take questions, which probably means that he has to stand at the front because he needs the microphone. We're going to take questions one by one, and I think the shorter and sharper the question, the shorter and sharper the answer. The gentleman has a microphone there. I'll leave you with the stage.
Peter Cole. I graduated with a law degree from LSE. I'd like to ask the chairman's one question. This year, there will be political transitions in China. And then we heard so much in North America about the Bosilai story. Will there be financial, economic, and political ramifications resulting from this?
You know, the Chinese political system has served this country well. I refer to the political system set up by our late leader Deng Xiaoping. We have very smooth transition all these years without surprises. And there's more transparency in the selection of the leaders from all the level up. As you know, probably China is the most democratic country in the whole world. You don't believe me, but let me tell you why. I worked for 30 years in the Chinese Ministry of Finance. For each and every promotion, I had to go through the public opinion survey. I must have had a vote more than 50% before the promotion was possible. And it's even tougher today after your name is announced for a possible promotion. For 2 weeks, the authority is waiting for complaints. They would go through some of the processes to see whether this guy is corrupted, this guy has any problems. If not, then you go through this process to be promoted. And this is not something which is practiced by Ministry of Finance. It's practiced by all of the governmental institutions. So this makes sure that we have a younger generation moving up over the years. And when you look at the senior leaders today, they are going to steer this country in the rough and tumble of the market economy. They went through these kind of, you know, exercises. And also, the transfer of power is not the same thing which happened in the Western countries. Over there, one batch of people left to be replaced by a new batch of people. Here you have the continuity. In the Politburo, some younger ones were moving up, will be moving up, and there will be new ones. So the policy continuity could be ensured. With regard to the Bolshevik issue, I made a speech in London, and some people asked me, do you think this is a power struggle? I said, definitely no. How could you be so sure? I said, this is a rule of law. This could not have happened for such a senior level people to be removed if we don't have the rule of law. And I think we in China are lucky, very lucky. Thank you.
Gentleman over there, let's just wait until the microphone comes to you.
Thank you, sir. I would like to ask you a question regarding the strategy and business mode of CIC in conducting overseas acquiring assets on behalf of China. For instance, as a sovereign wealth fund, you might partner with state-owned enterprises like PetroChina, like Sinopec, CNOOC. What is the exact role of CIC in these kind of moves? Thank you.
The mandate of CIC is to be a long-term financial investor. By long-term, we would invest in a company, in a sector, for many years to come. We are not going to pull out as soon as we see any troubles in a particular sector. So you can say sovereign wealth funds are even longer-term investors than the regular private equity funds. The mandate is to achieve reasonable risk-adjusted returns on our capital. Now, this is certainly the public money. But we make investment for the purpose of increasing the value of the public money. Other than that, we don't have any other motives. But of course, as I said, there's some perception about sovereign wealth funds, perception about CIC, because it's a company of China, because of China. So we are very careful not to create any misunderstanding or misinterpretation of our investment activities. We invest in a sector or in a company which is not considered sensitive. We avoid, for instance, defense industry. We will not be involved in any sector which would be creating a perception problems. If the recipient country thinks that this is going to be a national security problem for them, and if we cannot convince them that this is not the case, we might as well not to do it. Sometimes, as you know, some people will be very much worried when you take an equity share which goes above, say, 10%, 15%, 20%, because they are very much worried if you're a majority shareholder, then we would keep our equity share under, let's say, 10%, just to make these people feel a little bit more comfortable. Okay. But actually, sometimes a particular company would like to have more money from us, because they need liquidity, they need the capital. But we would work also with the regulatory bodies to make sure that this is possible. If they don't like it, we are quite happy to keep a low equity share. All of this indicates that CIC is a responsible investor. CIC wants to have a very good relationship with our counterparts in our countries, in our recipient countries. I also would like to highlight the point that a lot of things which we do not do, not because they are not money-making, on the contrary, they could be very profitable. But for reputational problems, we won't do it. You certainly won't see us in casino industries. You certainly won't see us in the tobacco industries. We won't do anything of that kind which is not good, either from an environmental point of view or from the social point of view. For instance, if there's any massive project which would create problems for resettlement, for the local indigenous people, we will be very careful. Thank you.
I think we've got time for two or three more questions before 7 o'clock, when there's going to be some food served. So there's a gentleman at the back, and then a gentleman very nicely dressed in a bow tie, and then a young lady here. So we'll take the gentleman at the back first.
It's on. Hi, my name is Dror Poleg. I'm from Israel. I did my master's at the LSE in economic history, focusing on China's financial markets and their development. I've been in China for 7.5 years. You mentioned before about the previous stimulus in response to the original crisis and how that was about the big word investment, which was possibly partly misallocated, but generally had a good effect, at least nominally, on the economy. And you mentioned that at the moment, we probably need to have more investment, but it's a different kind of investment that would be directed into 7 specific industries according to the latest 5-year plan. The question is, if we agree that the previous stimulus didn't help rebalance the economy, or at least didn't help rebalance it as much as it should have been, which brings us to where we are today, we know that the leaders back then were at least as clever and had as much information back then to decide where to channel these resources. Why should we assume that today, whatever they decide to do with it, they should make better decisions than they did back then?
I don't think it's an issue of for good decisions or better decisions. In the wake of the financial crisis originating in the United States subprime mortgage meltdown, you see, the government actually didn't take actions right away, because the impact of this crisis was not being felt in the first couple of months. And if you look at the analysis of International Monetary Fund, the Monetary Fund, International Monetary Fund, was quite serene about this crisis. The International Monetary Fund didn't alert the governments in the Western world or the emerging markets to the imminent disaster. This is, unfortunately, in my view, the misjudgment of the economists in International Monetary Fund. Please don't quote me, because I have lots of friends over there, right? But you will be making greater economists in the future. That's something I'm sure about. So, coming back to the issue, the Chinese government was still talking about keeping the inflation down, right? Do you remember that? Keeping the growth rate down in early 2008. And a couple months later, quickly, you know, reversed the policies, because the onslaught of impact was such that government was really caught a little bit napping. So I would say, in today's world, you probably think you are making judgments on your own. Actually, not. You are influenced by the opinions of a lot of people, knowingly or unknowingly. So I would say, at that time, the Chinese government had to take quick actions. When the house is on fire, you do not care whether the water is pouring over there or over here. You just pour the water on the house on fire. So, but the bystanders can say, hey, you guys are not using the water most efficiently. You know, this is very easy, but it's not really easy for the people who are in the middle of the game, right? So I would say any aggressive policy is likely to overshoot. This is quite normal. What is important is to do something to reverse the trend, to deal with the consequential consequences or unintended consequences of that policy right after you see the first sign of difficulty coming up. That is why Premier Wen Jiabao said preemptive actions and fine-tuning. This is why we have to do this now. So I'm not going to make any judgment on any policy which is good or better or not so good. I think what is important is to implement the policy decisively and then try to assess the effectiveness of that policy without delay. And then you take further actions to make sure that there will be smooth functioning of the economy. Thank you.
Bring the microphone down to the sharply dressed young man auditioning for the James Bond film. And then there's a young lady in front.
Thank you, Mr. Jin, and it was a very illuminating speech for you. My question is primarily about the regime shift you talk about, or the pattern shift. And specifically, my question is targeting the local SMEs. And I presume about the SME, it's supposed to be privately owned companies rather than state-owned companies. And in the wake of lower GDP growth and PE in China, private equity in China is not doing very well at the moment, what kind of sector would you think the local government would have an incentive to stimulate or kind of help to compete with state-owned enterprises, or to try to help it flourish? Or put it in a kind of a different perspective, if you were a private financial institution owner, and what kind of sector or private SMEs would you put your money in? Thank you.
You know, you have very good question with regard to the relationship between government and the private sector. In my view, the government's major responsibility is to create an enabling environment for the growth, development of the private sector SMEs. So the government should do something, for instance, financial sector reform, to roll back the entry barrier for the private financial institutions, investment companies, even insurance companies, something of that kind. But it's really left to the managers of SMEs to decide what they should do. I think it would be a disaster for the government to tell them, I believe this is very important, you guys should do it. No, I hope the government officials would refrain from giving this kind of advices, because that's really not good. You create the environment, you provide information about the economic development, the data about the demand, the supply, and all kind of basic economic information should be made available to the private business people to make their own judgments. So I would say if you do that, you have no worries about the mushrooming, about the development of the SMEs. As I said, it's important for our financial institutions to be more accommodating to the SMEs. And this is important, right? Then if you ask me what I do if I were in the private businesses, there are lots of things you can do. But what I can only tell you, because this is commercial, with confidential information, I suppose I'm going to do something tomorrow. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. I just tell you what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to do anything when there's so much fever about that. For instance, let me give you one example. We talk about new renewable energy categorically. I won't do that. Too much capacity at the very, very low levels. In 20 years' time, all these kind of investments, you look back, we say, like toys. If you really want to make investment in new energy, you have to think outside the box. Thank you very much. Now the last question for the lady.
Just pass the microphone to the person in front, and this will be the last question.
好，我的问题是，国家有消息称说，国家外管局将投资黑石集团的一项133亿美元的一个房地产基金的项目，说是5亿美元，那并将通过中投注入这笔基金，请问有没有这回事？然后还有是，中投已经和黑石集团已经合作过很多次，那么现在的投资回报率是多少？然后为什么总是选择黑石？谢谢。
You have a very interesting question, and because of confidentiality, I will invite you to my office tomorrow. Thank you.
I understood the question perfectly, but I particularly liked the answer. There is going to be food now available through those doors before we have the panel discussions afterwards. But it's my very great pleasure to thank Chairman Jin, Mr. Jin Lichun, for taking time out of his very busy schedule to be with us here tonight at the LSE China Conference 2012. We're most grateful to you both for your illuminating talk and for dealing so openly and humorously with the questions that you received from the floor. So now is the time, ladies and gentlemen, for a quick break. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, distinguished guests, LSE alumni and LSE colleagues. Welcome back to our LSE Beijing 2012 conference. This is the first panel for tonight. The title of the panel is Development Lessons from the Past for the Future. Not so long ago, about 20, 30 years ago, the dichotomy of the West and the rest is considered the standard sort of a formula to understand the world. However, with the rise of the debate of the great divergence and also the rise of the emerging economies like India, Latin America, and China, this idea, a shorthand for the European or Western triumphalism and the Eurocentricism, has been seriously challenged. So, for example, if we take the date of 1800, China and India accounted for about 2/3 of GDP in the world. Around 1900, that share dropped dramatically, but in year 2000, this share has been gradually reclaimed back to at least close to a quarter or even a third of the GDP. So we know for certain the center of gravity in this world, or in this, the economic gravity has been shifted from 1800 to 1900 now to year 2000. Now this panel deals with the engine of growth, development trajectory of growth, dynamic growth, the consequences of growth, and especially we draw lessons from the past to see how much we can understand our future. In our panel, we have two distinguished scholars from LSE, Professor Stuart Corbridge, currently the Pro Director of LSE, Professor of Developmental Studies, is specialized with India. He's a very productive writer. He has very wide range of interest, mainly in deal with governance, development consequences in India, and he will give us a talk for 20, 25 minutes. The discussant is my departmental colleague, not so long ago, the head of the Department of Economic History, Professor Colin Lewis. He is also a very productive writer. He has very broad interest in Latin America in terms of industrialization, modernization, and problems of equality, problems distribution of wealth. So this panel, and as a discussion, Colin will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes. Then we open the floor for debate and discussion. So let's welcome our speaker, Professor Corbridge, for his talk. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll keep to 25 minutes if I speak far too quickly. I already introduced the young man tonight as James Bond. I should probably introduce myself, therefore, as the Danny Boyle of the evening, the person that gave James Bond and Mr. Bean to the London Olympics. A rather quirky opening affair, and you might think that the title that I've chosen tonight is equally quirky. LSE students would quail, I imagine, or would be upset if we set an exam question such as this one, which I saw recently on the BBC website on the 13th of June 2012. Spain is not Uganda, discuss. It's the sort of thing that would make an undergraduate blanch, no doubt. But if you read it on, it actually says something rather interesting. Spanish Prime Minister Rajoy sent a text to his finance minister in the midst of negotiations on the terms of a bailout for Spain's banks. Urging him to hold out for a good deal, it said, quote, "We're the number four power in Europe. Spain is not Uganda." Now, this remark actually caused a storm of protest, as it goes on to say, in Uganda, with some ironic tweets pointing out Ugandan economic success as compared to the woes of Spain right now. When I saw this, I just thought it was a delicious sort of thing to see on the BBC website. And I've rather taken the opportunity to use it to think fairly critically about two of the main activities that I've been involved in my professional life. First of all, working for the development business. I've worked for the UK government's Department for International Development and the World Bank, and also teaching international development or development studies at the London School of Economics. And I want to structure my talk this evening around three words that are equally quirky: strangeness, indeterminacy, and humility. Now, my discussant, Professor Colin Lewis, will probably say shortly that the big difference between his subject, economic history, and my subject, development studies, is that one is based in scholarship and one is based far more in journalism. Now, he might be in part right. It's certainly true that students coming to the London School of Economics to do development studies generally want to do good. Not necessarily a bad thing. And rather a large number of students that come to the LSE to do development studies seem to think early on that development happens in the global south and is mainly post-1950. I'm happy to say, though, that in the very first lectures that we give, Colin, we disabuse them of both of these ideas. We argue fundamentally that the first key question in development studies is the big question. Why are some countries and regions richer or poorer than others? The second question that we pose to students is the one that we're discussing tonight, which is it ever possible for one country to learn meaningfully from another? If we take that first question, it's very clear, in fact, that there's a lot of common ground amongst us at the LSE. One can't begin to understand patterns of differential development without looking at things like colonial patterns of settlement, colonial path dependencies, and what my colleague Kent Deng was just talking about, the extraordinary divergence of incomes in the 19th century. I mean, just to repeat and slightly to amend a statistic that you just heard, in 1820, Asia collectively had about two-thirds of the world's population and about 52% of GDP. By 1950, its share of world population remained about the same at two-thirds, but its share of GDP was down to a low point of 17%. It was in the 19th century, fundamentally, that the third world, so-called, was produced. It wasn't named, of course, geopolitically, until in the 1950s, and then it was named mainly as a remainder space that was neither first world nor second world. So we would certainly accept the proposition that we need a good sense of history if we are to understand development fundamentally as the engines of accumulation that were bound up with what Danny Boyle was exploring in that rather quirky first part of the Olympic Games. When the smokestacks go up, we get the Industrial Revolution in the UK and then its gradual diffusion to other parts of the world. I think, though, that there's another story, another historical story, which development studies is much less willing to acknowledge and possibly has been explored by economic historians, which is a story around race. And one of the first things that occurred to me when I read this comment by the Spanish finance minister is that there's an element here of race in the characterization of Uganda vis-a-vis the fourth-ranking European power. And I want to suggest to you that the modern conception of development is hugely new and hugely strange. And by that I simply mean that the idea that they could become like us, particularly that black Africans could become like the Spanish or the UK, is a remarkably new idea. And it was struggled for mainly by members of nationalist movements, obviously in China, people like Sun Yat-sen as well, major intellectuals, by Gandhi, by Nehru, but also by less well-known figures that were involved in the Pan-African Congress, people like George Padmore, and by two of LSE's most distinguished alumni, Kwame Nkrumah and Jomo Kenyatta. All of those people, along with Professor Fei Shangtong, attended the Malinowski Seminar in the Department of Anthropology at LSE at some point. I don't think we've yet done the history on how far they connected. But their capacity to challenge prevailing wisdom is, I think, one that's well worth reflecting upon. Maybe you can see what I'm getting at here simply by taking a look at this forbiddingly long quotation from a person up the road, happily not an LSE professor, but a professor of geography at UCL, writing in a book from 1932 called Geography and World Power. Just see how different this is from a conception that they can become like us. Thus Africa, announces Fairgrieve, long occupied by barbarous peoples, unknown and unexplored because of geographical conditions, has lately, naturally, and inevitably been partitioned by the peoples that matter. And those who matter most have had the most say in the partitioning. This is obviously the British, followed by the French. But still the native races remain. It's almost like a complaint. They are still agricultural and pastoral, and their treatment constitutes a problem which is not yet solved. Now, this is soft stuff, of course, compared to what was going on in Nazi Germany at this time, and compared to the whole logics of so-called scientific or social Darwinism that really became the major ideology of the age of empire and the age of industry. To move from 1932 to John Kennedy's declaration at the UN General Assembly in 1961 that the 60s would be, quote, the, in the singular, development decade, presupposed an enormous amount of work to mainstream the idea that non-Western peoples could become as successful through their own efforts as Western peoples. I want to suggest that that idea, in fact, is quite strange and quite recent. So that's my first point. Now, my second interpretation of the Spanish finance minister's comments is that he might be fairly familiar with contemporary development economics. And if so, it might be, when he looks at Uganda, that he is a follower of Jeffrey Sachs. Now, Jeffrey Sachs, many of you will know, is perhaps the most prominent figure in the development industry. He moved from Harvard to Columbia, he was a key advisor to Kofi Annan, he is the eminence grise behind the Millennium Development Goals, and he worked with Prime Minister Gordon Brown on the Plan for Africa. And Jeffrey Sachs fundamentally suggests, which is rather amusing to those of us that are geographers, that the main reason why Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, but also parts of South America and Asia are poor, is simply that they are the prisoners of bad geography. That the fundamental exogenous variable in determinations of income and poverty are tropicality, rainfall systems, soil systems, and the various infectious diseases to which they give rise, both in human populations and in animal populations, all of which might be expected to lower rates of agricultural productivity. Even worse, there is a penalty to be paid if your country is particularly rugged and mountainous, and or, like Chad and Mali and Burkina Faso, it is landlocked. It's not a new idea. The World Bank was propagating this in 1976 through Andrew Kamark, as you can see, a book called The Tropics and Economic Development, a provocative inquiry into the poverty of nations. But Kamark was certainly not Adam Smith. This is the Saxian proof, allegedly, of his point of view. You won't be surprised to see here that GDP per capita tends to congregate into the higher latitudes of the temperate areas north, on the left as you look at it, and in the 30s, 40s, and 50 degrees south. The poor countries, Sachs points out, tend to be congregated around the equator and in the tropics. Even a 10-year-old child could see, says Jeffrey, that the main determinant of poverty and prosperity is simply geography. So perhaps this is what the Spanish finance minister had in mind. The aid industry loves Jeffrey Sachs, because Jeffrey Sachs is not in fact maintaining that we are the prisoners of geography. Rather, heroically and in a Promethean fashion, we should learn to overcome geography. By transfers, by the year 2015, he suggests, of $200 US billion a year in the form of official development assistance. We can overcome geography by building roads and railways, better ports and airports. We can overcome bad geography with treated malaria nets, antiretrovirals. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. Now, we can support many of these propositions, of course, in terms of policy. I'm in favour of treated malaria nets, without necessarily endorsing the underlying intellectual logic of the Saxian view of bad geography. As one of my students pointed out this morning when we discussed this at Beidar, Sachs fails to neglect that there's good geography in the tropics too. It's actually easier to be a farmer in Costa Rica than in Iceland. He tends also to neglect the fact that there is bad geography in temperate areas. A lot of people used to die of something called cholera in England in the 1840s. Probably one of the greatest killers of the 20th century was the so-called, ironically, Spanish influenza that followed World War I and was particularly damaging in temperate areas. This is not particularly, I think, good social science. Jeffrey also has to face the two dreaded words, Switzerland and Nogales. Switzerland is the answer that smart people give to the argument that being landlocked is a bad thing. It depends who your neighbours are. It's not too bad being landlocked if your neighbours are Germany. I was going to say Italy, but that's a little bit more problematic now than it was a couple of years ago. Nogales features in the very first pages of the hot best-selling book in economic development this year by Darren Acemoglu, happily a PhD student once at the LSE, now at MIT, and James Robinson in the Department of Government at Harvard University. And Nogales is this dreaded town on the border that is shared between Mexico and the US state of Texas. And as they go on to point out at great length, it is a heck of a lot better to live on the US side of the border than on the Mexican side of the border, which suggests perhaps that geography isn't quite the determining factor that Sachs and others might maintain. Now, to be fair to Sachs, Nogales is not in the tropics, but one sees the direction of the argument. More seriously, Harvard economist Danny Roderick and his longtime collaborator, Arvind Subramaniam, who's worked extensively with the IMF, have tried to assess to what extent geography has an effect independent of what we might call politics or the quality of institutions, the rules of the game that structure social interactions or incentive systems. They've maintained famously that the quality of institutions, proxied here by property rights protection and the strength of the rule of law, is the only positive and significant determinant of income levels. Once institutions are controlled for, integration, if you like globalization or trade policy, has no direct effect on incomes, surprising, while geography has at best weak direct effects. That doesn't show terribly well, but this is from a fairly famous paper published by Roderick and Subramanian, and you see that clear statistically significant relationship on the left for institutional quality against a log of GDP per capita. If it showed up more clearly, you would see that the links to geography and integration are much more weakly established and, in fact, are actually running in the wrong direction for the arguments of people that wish to propose them. Now, our mythical Spanish finance minister at this point, if he was an institutionalist, might be thinking that what is needed most in Uganda is for Uganda to become like Spain. This, of course, is a famous proposition in development studies. It's often said in the UK that the UK would be better off if it was more like Germany. How meaningful is that as a proposition? If Britain was going to be more like Germany, it would be called Germany, most likely. The intellectual points here, first, if we believe Easterly and Levine, are that macroeconomic policies do not have a significant effect on incomes once institutions are controlled for. This is a terrifying thought because it means that policymakers and politicians are fundamentally imprisoned by institutions which are strongly path-dependent and which they inherit from others. Not exactly what a Promethean politician wants to be told, which is partly why Jeffrey Sachs is more popular. Danny Roderick and his colleague also says that the operational guidance that our central result on the primacy of institutional quality yields is extremely meager. This is the point about indeterminacy. They go on, a long quote, obviously the presence of clear property rights for investors is key. Nobody in this room would dispute that, I expect. Our findings indicate that where their property rights are protected, the economy ends up richer. Nobody likes being expropriated. Nobody likes the absence of the rule of law. But, they say, nothing is implied about the actual form that property rights should take. We cannot even necessarily deduce that enacting a private property rights regime, so beloved by Washington, would produce superior results compared to alternative forms of property rights. The rise of China, of course, is precisely behind the thinking in this slide. The point that I'm making here is that people who want to claim that the key message from institutional policy is that they should become more like us are, in a sense, missing a very disconcerting point. We tend to have institutions for a reason. They tend to be strongly path-dependent. They tend to be, in large part, endogenous to place. What could it possibly mean to say that Uganda should be more like Spain? What does it really mean for Indians to complain if only they'd been more like South Korea after 1966 when the Indians devalued the rupee? It's not immediately clear that institutions are exportable in that fashion. I'm not even clear particularly that they're importable either. This is a humbling thought. We can clearly learn some lessons from developmental successes and failures, but I suggest that many of the main macro lessons that we can learn are pretty obvious and rather negative. It does not make sense for a country to be run by somebody like Pol Pot in the way that Pol Pot ran his country. I think we can all agree on that. It does not make sense to have a policy that supports hyperinflation. It does not make sense to cut your economy off from the global economy over a period of 20, 30, or 40 years. It does not make sense to allow generalized rent seeking, particularly when the profits of rent seeking are poorly disposed of. In a sense, when you read the original Washington Consensus by John Williamson, a considerate and clever man, that was the point that he was making. He was not commending policies that work so much as warning us against policies that don't work. If we look at many of the success stories of the past 200 years, they've begun with violence. The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Meiji Revolution, the Maoist Revolution, if you like, the post-1979 revolution also in this country. Sometimes we're reluctant, and the development industry hates this, to face up to the fact that violence and regime change can actually be productive, because it is the one set of policies, if you like, not that they would be entertained as such, which truly break long-standing institutional path dependencies. Let me end, though, by allowing my mythical students at London and perhaps also the Spanish finance minister some room for hope amidst this sense of strangeness and humility. I've worked for too long, in fact, well over 35 years on India, not sadly on China. But India is fascinating to social scientists at the moment, and we're seeing large numbers of people pile into the study of India who aren't learning the language and don't define themselves as Indianists. They're interested because India is of generic social science significance. Most countries do not sustain a democracy at low per capita incomes. India has. Why? Most countries with huge levels of ethnic variation, linguistic variation, what social scientists call ethnic fractionalization, break up. India has not. Why? Mainly because of force is the answer. India is perhaps the only country in the world where poor rural women are more likely to vote in parliamentary elections than rich urban males. Why? Notwithstanding that, why is Indian government so unresponsive to its citizens in terms of service delivery? But the issue that I want to focus on and end with is the one after the hyphen. India is fascinating, I think, if you're a development economist, because it's had 30 years now, 32 years, of sustained economic growth. The last time the economy contracted was 1979 to 80. India's recent economic growth performance is not post-1991, it's post-1980. I see no evidence in India that its geography has suddenly got better. The railroads were built a long time ago. Nor is there much evidence in India that its institutional quality has improved. If anything, most people think the institutional quality in India has weakened, particularly as measured by corruption. That suggests to me, contrary to Easterly and Levine, that policy does matter. And it's the consistency of policy that's mattered in India. The fact that governments of different stripes, including the Hindu nationalists, have slowly but consistently edged the economy first to pro-business policies and latterly to pro-market policies. Lastly, if you want to be sucked into development studies, I am finishing. If you want to be sucked into development studies, the micro side is perhaps more uplifting than the macro. If we look at where the great weight of development economics has been recently and where PhD students are attracted, they're attracted to the sort of work that you see in a wonderful book by two colleagues at MIT, Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. Microeconomics or mesoeconomics is allowing scholars to intervene practically through randomized field evaluations. Where I've lived for 3 years in a village in eastern India, there's about a 1 in 3 chance that the school teacher will turn up. He's getting paid, but he doesn't turn up. Kids suffer low literacy, low levels of human capital accumulation in consequence. What to do? Take 3,000 villages and divide them up into 7 groups. Let's make it 4,200. I can do the math more easily then. 4,200 villages, split them into 7 groups. In 600 villages, you do nothing. In the other 6 villages, you treat them in particular ways. You can see there, second to the left, that you can provide teachers with a digital camera. They can at least, as parents, find out whether the guy is in the village that day through a time-dated mechanism. Not going to ensure that he teaches properly, but at least he has to turn up, you might think. Computer-assisted learning, an extra year of schooling. But by far the most effective intervention that this program revealed is on your extreme left. You simply take the brightest boy or girl in the village and you pay them a small stipend to teach the other kids. The cost effectiveness of this program is statistically rigorously proven, and it offers great policy advice to the governments of states like Madhya Pradesh, Bihar, and Orissa. So fear not if you are intending to come to the London School of Economics to read development studies. We will provide you, I hope, with a sense of the strangeness of the world. Every time I use an ATM, I think how strange this is. You think what an ATM symbolizes. Weeks worth of work and I go to a hole in the wall, put in a piece of plastic and I get money. We should think this is hugely strange, albeit deeply efficient in terms of transaction costs. Secondly, I think we have to have the humbleness to understand that, as Robert Solow says, There are at least 102 growth theories at the moment, which is great, but we don't know which is the best of them, which is a problem. There's nothing wrong with that. Social science deals with open systems. But we do have to accept at times that because we can't close the systems, randomized field trials being an exception to that rule, we have to accept the fact that our arguments are open to contestation by others. Einstein always said he was only interested in one thing, being proven wrong. I think that's the correct attitude for a social scientist. Humility, but with a certain amount of reason. A certain amount of reason is that we have learned certain things, particularly negative things in macro terms, and we are learning a great deal also in micro terms. So that's my message to you tonight as your Danny Boyle. Thank you.
Thanks so very much, Professor Corbett. This certainly reminds us of the style of LSE teaching and the public speech. And certain. So let me invite Professor Colin Lewis for his response or comments on Professor Corbett's talk.
Well, already I'm pressing buttons which I didn't intend to press, so let's see if I can... Steve, do you have to remind me? Should I get it back?
Green.
Green.
Let's go back to red one.
You can see that economic historians are particularly antediluvian and dinosaurian. And, while professors of international development might find cash machines strange, professors of economic history find any gadget strange. It's a great pleasure to be invited to respond to Professor Corbridge's remarks. It's a pleasure and a privilege. The Departments of International Development and Economic History have collaborated in a number of ways over the years. We run combined courses, we've engaged in collaborative research, and if I may say so, very occasionally we engage in friendly competition of clearly the best sort of competition. In responding to Professor Corbett tonight, I want to focus very much on his observations about institutions, institutional change, and whether or not institutions can be transferred. Before I do so, however, as Stuart feared, if you invite an economic historian to respond to a development studies presentation, then you're going to get some history. Yeah? Whether you like it or not, you're going to get some history. So for the next couple of minutes, I'm going to trot out the proverbial data. Earlier this evening, both Kent and Stuart have referred to changing positions in the global economy. So I'm going to provide some of those indicators of change in the global economy before focusing more narrowly on institutions and institutional change. So here we have a view of GDP per capita growth in the long run, or rather from 1700 to just into the 21st century. The countries in the chart are obvious: the USA, Japan, China, South Africa, and Brazil. Okay, if we look at the far right of the chart, then some, I guess, might be surprised by the fact that China features as such a low bar. Yeah? This is indeed the 21st century. It's not that my data stops at 1999. This brings us well into 2010. The point that I'm making is a very obvious one, but it's one I think that bears reiteration. In other words, if we measure China in aggregate terms, we know it's now a very big player in the international economy. If we look at China in per capita terms, then in fact it's not such a big player even now in the early 21st century. Paradoxically, you can see that the China bar stands below the Brazil and South Africa bar. Yeah, for sure, they are much smaller economies, but in per capita terms, they weigh heavier. Yeah. Here, if we look at GDP growth in aggregate, then obviously China is large at the beginning of on the far left of the chart, and China is reappearing as we move to the right of the chart. Yeah? Bearing in mind that the final set of graphs, the final set of bars, covers a fairly long period, so this was before the recent growth spurt in China. I'd like to emphasize this point about growth spurt because it's something I'll come back to when talking about institutional change. Here I get, I suppose, is the big historical chart. It's one, it's data that Stuart and Kent alluded to earlier. In other words, at some point in the past, in the far distant past and the not so far distant past, Asia, particularly China and India, weighed very large in the international economy. Yeah? As we move from left to right, we can see the share of Asia in international GDP being compressed. But as we get to the last couple of decades, we see evidence of the reemergence of India and China, particularly of China. Yeah. So we know that China, in aggregate terms, is looming larger in the international economy, that China perhaps is recapturing part of the position that it held in the past. And that, in a sense, explains perhaps the subtitle of my response to Stuart tonight, is the past the future? As we look at the past, as we see the emergence of China, does it mean that we're going to see China get bigger and bigger? Well, there might be another way of looking at the global economy. And this is not so much in terms of countries, but rather in terms of regions. Now, you can cut regions any way as you wish. And clearly, I've cut these regions in a way that best illustrates the point that I want to make. Historians are very good at choosing their data selectively and carefully. You always choose the data that proves your case. Yeah? I'm sure that's something that all social scientists know very well, though not all are prepared to admit it. Historians say, of course you have to look at your data carefully, but make sure it tells the right story. Yeah? So the story I want to tell is of a sort of convergence. But perhaps the point I'm really trying to make here is that we certainly in the early 21st century are seeing the emergence of, yes, individual national global players, but perhaps even more than globalization, we are seeing regionalization. And again, this will chime with a point that I'm trying to make in a moment's time, that perhaps it's easier to transfer or borrow institutions at a regional level rather than at a global level. Clearly, an interesting point in this chart is that while we have convergence between Europe, USA, and Asia-Oceania in terms of share of world GDP, the curves for Africa and Latin America are pretty flat. Yeah? They continue to bounce along the bottom. Okay, folks, that's the end of stylized historical data. Let me move now more particularly to the theme of this evening's this section of the evening, learning from development studies and history. As Stuart was saying earlier, classic question that all students in many departments in the LSE are asked is, why are some countries rich? Why are some countries poor? Why do some countries develop before others? Why do some countries continue on a developmental trajectory while others are less fortunate? Is it about geography? Is it institutions? Is it shocks? Luck. Well, luck is also important. For me, shocks are particularly important. Shocks are particularly important in affecting institutional change. And, you know, here we have a sort of, I would say, here's a stylized view of the political economy experience of various countries in the world at different points in time. We have perhaps famously starting from a point of chaos, disorder. Disorder, of course, can reoccur from time to time. In a number of cases, we see countries moving along a virtuous trajectory from chaos or economic and political disorder to authoritarian order. We're always told that authoritarian order is good for growth, and then moving on to some sort of democratic order. A utopian view of political and economic change with accompanying institutional modernization. Yeah? But there's also another course. Yeah? It seems that in some places, individual countries or regions are locked into this dual arrangement of chaos, disorder, leading to authoritarian order, and then back to some sort of chaotic situation. For me, as I was saying earlier, that shock is an important way of triggering processes of change, but shock alone will not produce, inverted commas, good change. Yeah? So here I have a couple of trite, they're certainly textbook trite examples of institutional change, which I would say reflect a process of institutional borrowing and internal institutional manipulation. Everybody, every schoolboy and every schoolgirl knows about examples of the glorious and bloodless revolution in England, and it was in England, not in the UK, though clearly it has implications for the rest of the UK, it has implications for the creation of the UK in 1688. And on the other hand, we have an Asian model, Japan. The story that's told with the emergence of the black ships, leading on perhaps not so directly, but certainly there's a connection with the Meiji Restoration a decade or so later. These are shocks, yeah? The question is to what extent are they endogenous or exogenous? Shocks, more particularly the responses that are produced in these two societies. Well, if you look at the Glorious and Bloodless Revolution, as all the textbooks tell us, that what England did was to import a king. Whether importing a king means importing institutions, I don't know. But certainly it was a symbolic import. On the other hand, the point I'm trying to make here is most of the changes came from within. In other words, while the king might have been imported, which king to import was an internally made decision. Yeah. Importing a king facilitated the development, the emergence of a number of key institutions or perhaps key agencies. And again, on the left, we have a checkbook list of what happened. And some of my colleagues in the department at LSE would say, what we see at this point is the creation of a fiscal state, and what did that fiscal state do was to make war, and making war was good for economic growth in England. I would not necessarily subscribe to that view, but clearly warfare does have its costs as well as benefits. If we look at the Japanese case, what do we see? Well, for sure, there's no importing of a monarch, perhaps the restitution of an emperor. The choice there was rather more limited, but the restitution of a figure, an important figure, facilitates internal debates, and again, perhaps the importing of some institutions, but much, much, much more particularly, the adapting of a limited number of imported institutions to local considerations. I will finish in 5 minutes, guaranteed, Kent, yeah? Because now we move on to a part of the my response, which is an area that I know a little bit more about. And it combines these elements of shock and institutional change. In the late 19th, early 20th century, many countries in Latin America experienced a growth shock. In other words, rates of growth which were historically high and sustained over a number of decades. Yeah. after, with rapid economic growth, there was societal change or social protest, call it what you will, and a threat to order. Yeah? So the question was with this threat to order, what were the ways out? I simply cite two rather trite examples. Again, I've chosen my examples carefully to prove the case I want to make. Yeah? In the case of Mexico, elite groups at the time found it very, very difficult to decide as to what sort of response to make to the growth shock. In the Argentinian case, and in Mexico, a lack of elite consensus, perhaps not even sustained debate within the elite, led to revolution. A revolution that was particularly violent, lasted a very long time, perhaps some would say Mexico is now, only in the last couple of decades, emerging from the consequences of the Mexican Revolution. In the Argentinian case, there was a different sort of decision, an intra-elite collective decision to facilitate a degree of opening, a degree of political opening. And that facilitated, at least for a couple more decades, sustained growth in the Argentinian case. Yeah? I'm not saying that the Argentinian example is a particularly good one, but it serves my purpose, it illustrates my point for the early 20th century. So I'm making this point here. Shocks are important. Economic shocks often drive institutional change. The critical decision, and here I think that Stuart and I would agree in some areas and disagree in others, the critical case is what sort of choices are made and whether those choices are being made internally. I'm on the final run now, Kent, my last 95 seconds, yeah? Because the biggest shock of all, I guess, would be industrialization. Yeah? Industrialization, I think one could argue, as a bundle of institutions and policies. And here I have a couple of quotes, one from a distinguished economic historian, colleague Kent's and mine, Patrick O'Brien, who says that for real and sustained development, there's no substitute for industrialization. Yeah? Industrialization matters. Again, it's a question of the consequences, the outcome of industrialization. And Alice Amsden, a development sociologist with much experience of East Asia, is pointing to the importance of industrialization leading to a more equitable society. Yeah? You can have a growth shock. The growth shock can facilitate industrialization, but critically, the question is, what type of industrialization do you get, and what are the equity, welfare, consequences of the model of industrialization? I will short-circuit the next couple of slides, which basically look at welfare outcomes. And this would be my final checklist. Yeah? I guess here I'm agreeing with Stuart implicitly. In other words, learning from mistakes is as important as learning from successes. Sometimes it's more important to learn from failures than from successes. If the debate now is about which institutions, whether institutions can facilitate development, and I think we would all argue they can, the question is, can you import institutions? And I would argue that one of the lessons of my little history lesson is that you cannot export institutions. Institutions can only be imported. Yeah? And that means taking decisions about how to import institutions, how to embed them. And the result must be to reduce poverty and inequality. And I'm more than happy to leave the last word, not with myself, but with Marshall, who gives us, I think, a route map of shock, economic shock, political change, and perhaps utopian outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you, Colin. I can see both sides. This is a really real debate from the point of view of Professor Corbridge. Things can never be equal. Therefore, different patterns of growth will emerge in different parts of the world differently. From the point of view of Professor Lewis, other things being equal, you need shocks to change the world. Okay, now, could I invite Professor Corbridge to respond to, just briefly, the opinions presented by Colin, and then we open the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me at the back? Yes, I'm not going to take very long because I think it's important to open it up to the floor. I mean, it seems to me, Colin, that fundamentally we're in agreement despite teasing one another on the fundamentals. I think we're both agreed that the idea that development can be secured easily by exporting institutions is something of a fallacy, although it's a fallacy that's perhaps incorporated into a lot of the literature now on good governance. I'm not entirely sure if we can't export institutions exactly how we import institutions, and maybe we can discuss that a little bit further. Notwithstanding what I said about institutions, I do actually take the view that institutions are less controlling than people like Easterly and Levine would make out. It seems to me that policy actually makes a great deal more difference in many cases, stable countries, perhaps some democracies, some less democratic states, than have been allowed now in this institutionalist literature. But I think the other area of major agreement between us is that we can't begin to think about development issues with a very short time period. The end of Malthusia came for most people sometime in the 19th century or the 20th century. And I think we need to be alert to the fact that the contemporary development era, so-called, and the great idea or ideology of development is itself quite recent and quite strange.
Thanks so much. I think, you know, I will break the LOC sort of a stereotype. I'm not going to abuse my privilege as chair, so the floor is open. Yeah. And any question? Okay. This young lady in the front.
So, like, recently, and like as always, developing countries have always received criticisms from many developed countries in terms of the protective measures and policies. And, for example, U.S. Senate and the British unions have always blamed China for its protective policies to, let's say, fix the exchange rate and protect the major exporting industries. But like when we look at the economic history and look at South Korea, for example, all those protective measures and policies were very crucial for Korea to climb up the economic ladder, as some South Korean economists said. So my question is what your YouTube professors' views on that, and especially for Corbridge, what's your views, especially for China, India, and these developing countries? Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very good question. The South Korean economist you're referring to is a good friend of mine, Ha Jun Chang, who wrote a famous book called Kicking Away the Ladder, which actually is a quotation from Friedrich List, the great German political economist of the mid-19th century, who said in a nutshell, it's very easy for the country that's already industrialized to proclaim the virtues of things like, or latterly democracy at that time, free trade, and then to kick away the ladder to countries that follow afterwards. And that perhaps is the measure of Western hypocrisy that you're talking about. I think that's partly true. I mean, if we say, and I would agree with Colin, that one of the goals of development is generally that we would move away from agriculture towards industrialization. And if we define structural transformation as the movement to an economy in at least out of which at least 50% of the population work outside agriculture, name one country that's done that as a democracy. In other words, with full universal suffrage. Maybe India will, but the United States didn't have full universal suffrage till 1965, as far as I'm concerned. And if we're talking about women in Europe, it comes well after the Industrial Revolution. Name one country that actually developed without high endemic levels of corruption. Rotten boroughs in 19th century, England, Tammany Hall, in the United States, South Korea. I mean, in many ways, we need to look at how corrupt proceeds are effectively used. So in all of those senses, and of course currency manipulation as it's described, I think all of those things are rightly going to raise the hackles of people who will say, but you did it first. I don't think, though, and I'll conclude and pass to Colin, that that means that the West can't begin to look in on the development patterns of other countries, including China, and offer advice of a more friendly and less obviously biased fashion than that. I mean, we can have very interesting debates, for example, around why China has been so effective in terms of converting growth into poverty reduction. China has been twice as effective as India over the past 30 years. I think it's the nature of those conversations that we should be having rather than the hypocrisy that you're concerned with.
Anything Colin want to come along? Thanks.
Is it? Yeah. I agree entirely with Professors Chang and Corbridge. In other words, if one looks at processes of rapid industrialization across time and across the world in the modern era, it's very difficult to find an example of a case where domestic industrialization did not start from anything other than trade protection. Yes, well, one's looking at late 18th, early 19th century England, mid-19th century Germany, late 19th century Japan, late 19th century USA, all of these places industrialized rapidly with protection. The critical point, however, is what happens after the initial surge of industrialization. In other words, it's moving from a protected to a less protected economy. And there, I think, there are lots of examples of failures. Once industrialization starts behind very high protectionist barriers, it's not easy to bring those protectionist barriers down in order to facilitate increasing domestic competition and efficiency, as well as facilitating international trade. There, I think that there are nice contrasts between what's been done in some East Asian economies and what was the case in Latin America. In Latin America, there are lots of examples of countries that grew rapidly, that their industry sector grew rapidly with protection, but then found it very, very difficult to dismantle protection. Whereas in parts of East Asia, we have examples of countries moving from high protection to a more moderate level of protection and gradually reducing the protective barriers. So policy is important, and there are lots of historical examples of failure as well as success.
More questions, please? Thank you. More questions? Really? That's very unusual. Yes, please. James Wong. Chinese type.
Thank you, professors. This question is for both Professor Corbridge and Professor Lewis. The World Bank has recently published a working paper saying kind of the development plan for the next 30 years in China. And it has heavily emphasized on privatization of state enterprises and also liberalization of the government-controlled finance policies. So I'm just wondering what's your view on this. And considering the history of England, when Mrs. Thatcher liberalized the industry, what's your view on China and perhaps in the next 10, 20 years, should the government adopt this policy? And is that plausible? Thank you.
Right. Colin.
Yeah. Okay, if I can start with the second part of your question. Liberalizing financial markets, I interpret it loosely in terms of liberalizing financial markets. I think one has to be very, very careful. Again, I speak as an economic historian, not only of Latin America, but of comparative development. And there I think we see that where there is a rapid liberalization of financial markets, then what you get is the classic boom and bust. So if there are any Chinese policymakers here thinking of liberalizing domestic financial markets, I would say be very careful and do it extremely slowly. Yeah? I think also recent events in the United States and Europe indicate that where there is financial market liberalization, there also has to be effective regulation, particularly in financial markets, because as our keynote speaker said this evening, Those who often protest most loudly against state action are the first to clamor for state aid when there are difficulties. I do believe that financial market liberalization in the long run produces positive results. In the short run, I think that the whole process has to be handled very, very carefully. So I think slow financial market liberalization with very effective regulation. The first part of your question was about privatization. Well, I'm afraid I'm a good old-fashioned neo-Keynesian here. I think that there are some things that the state really has to do. There are some things that the state does better. Now, I'm not saying that these things are the same in every country at all place at all times, but there are certain sorts of things that only the state can do. There are other things that the state, that the private sector can do better. But excessive, rapid, and unwarranted privatization, again, provide us with examples of failure of what to avoid if we look at parts of Europe, not least the UK.
I'm going to add very little because I think I agree with everything, in fact, that Colin said there. I'm certainly old enough to remember the Thatcher years. Privatising car factories probably made a lot of sense. Maybe privatising British Airways made a lot of sense. Privatising the railroads seems to me to make a lot less sense. But fundamentally, these were always, of course, political acts. The question about the car factories was not so much whether they better run in private hands than in government hands, but the fact that at the same time, the trade union movement was heavily weakened, which allowed the privatised car factories to be run in a more effective fashion. So I think whether it's privatisation or state ownership is only one part of a triangle that Colin also brought in with respect to regulation. I'd also agree very strongly in terms of temporality, of sequencing, and slowness. One of the great conceits of the development industry is that things have to happen, can happen, and should happen quickly. I don't think that has been the lesson of many of the most advanced industrial countries. One of the things that is interesting about India, the country that I know rather better, is that many people will say that economic reform in India has been too slow. It's certainly been a lot slower than what Jeffrey Sachs proposed for Boris Yeltsin in Russia. But I don't think that that lack of speed has necessarily served India badly. One has to make sure that the losers of economic reform are in a minority, or that there's various side payments are made to them to bring them on board. And I think that India has handled that question very effectively. I'm sure that China will do so equally.
Well, thank you so very much. On that note, we conclude this panel. I will thank again the presenters and discussant. Thank you so much. So we have another panel. Yes, thank you.
Going straight into it,
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second panel of this evening of the LSE China Forum. As you can see from the notice that's up on the screen, this is a panel on managing the benefits of economic growth. Before I introduce the speaker and the respondent, I want to set a context for the discussion and the conversation that I hope the panelists up here will have with you, the audience. When we talk about managing the benefits of economic growth, our immediate thought is we must be studying economies that are growing rapidly or that are strong, powerful economies, but that for some reason, the benefits to that economic growth are not appropriately given out, are not appropriately shared. And the reason we think as social scientists, as sociologists, as participants in civil society, the reason that we think this is very important is that we know that when economies grow, the pie of resources that is available increases. But whether that pie is large or small, such a pie can be divided in all kinds of different ways. So when we talk about appropriately managing these resources, all of us take a view on the trade-off between giving these resources to different segments of society or dividing them between generations alive today and generations yet to be born in the future. Dividing up resources entails not just ordinary and direct redistribution, however, but in most of our minds, as observers of the process of development that's going on out there, we also think that it has to do with building a civil society. It has to do with constructing political institutions to guard against extractive elites and to build governments that can respond to checks and balances. Most of us consider ourselves sensible and reasonable when it comes to questions like this. We agree a lot with the people around us, and we have well-defined views on where unfairness in growth arises. Unfairness in dimensions that the panelists will explore in just a few minutes. When we see a country, a world economic power, that actually squeezes downwards the incomes of its middle class and makes its poor even poorer, at the same time that total national income increases faster than it ever has in the past, we think that there's something wrong with that country. When we look at that country and we look at its rail transportation, a cheap way, a populous way to move poor people, vast differences efficiently, and we see that same country recently suffer deaths from accidents on the rails, deaths that run into scores of people, our alarm bells sound even more loudly. When that country has its top 1% own more than 90% of their fellow citizens, when in the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis, 93% of the income gain goes to the richest 1%, 37%, a staggering 37%, goes to the richest 0.01%, we become even more alarmed. When that country is so unable to provide for its younger generation that one-fifth of men aged 25 to 34 find it too expensive to do anything but to live at home still with their parents, where the wealth of households headed by people under the age of 35 today is only one-third what it was 25 years ago, where the poor in that country will soon be reduced to begging for medical care because they are unable to purchase affordable health insurance, when that country is the one that contains the world's largest corporate collapses of the last decade due to criminal fraud, when that country's leader accepts the obligation that together with just one other person, he can make the decision to execute anyone, anywhere in the world, once they determine that someone in their eyes is a bad person, well, we should all be horrified. The country that I have just described is the United States. Thank you very much. That and other indicators tell us that when we look around the world, the problem of managing the benefits and managing the resources to economic growth is a real problem worldwide. And it is a profound and important problem that as social scientists, as policymakers, we need to address. Now, up here on the panel with me this evening, we have two experts to help us guide us through this maze of thinking. Okay. The speaker will be Mr. Goh Chai Boon, who is Senior Vice President and Head of China Partnerships of the Government Investment Corporation of Singapore. As you know, in parallel to CIC, from whom Mr. Chin spoke earlier this evening, GIC, the Government Investment Corporation of Singapore, manages the financial reserves of the Singapore government. Mr. Goh represents GIC in China, and he heads the effort to integrate and synergize GIC's different investments across China. He has, in his remarkable career, taken on different tasks, among them being serving as CEO of the Sino-Singapore Tianjin Eco-City project. Mr. Goh will speak for 20 minutes to share with us his experiences on what it means to manage the resources in economic growth. After that, we will have a response from Professor Ma Rong, who is Professor of Sociology at Peking University. Professor Ma Rong works on social and developmental problems, with a particular emphasis in China on this country's poorer regions, Xinjiang, Tibet, and the southwestern part of China. If you could join me in welcoming these two panelists, and in particular, Mr. Goh, first of all, to come to the podium. Thank you very much.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm quite happy to be, it's a great honor for me to be here actually. About 20 years ago, I graduated from the London School of Economics. That's June 1992, at the age, much like all of you out there. I think I better take my handphone away.
Should I keep your BlackBerry?
Back in 92, when I finished my degree course in London School of Economics, one thing tell me that I was wrong all my life. Before I went to London, I have always wanted to be a professor. I wanted to do economic research all my life, and maybe brief economic research until my last breath. And while I'm not saying that LSE taught me not to, and certainly all of you will be enjoying the benefit of LSE education. What LSE has taught me has benefited me personally a lot because in a very strange way, I wanted to finish my study very fast. I could have finished in my second year if LSE allowed me to graduate. And when I get back home, there was a lot of things to be done. And even though it was a fast-growing economy, a country that has much success by the late 80s, early 90s, there were a lot of things to be done. Today, after reflecting about my work for the last two decades, as a practitioner, I'm not an expert. I'm not a professor in social studies. But after reflecting about what I went through in a quick two decades of being in the civil service of Singapore, I decided that I will not talk about economic development because I was at the center of that. For the last 20 years, I was actually involved in much of the economic development policy makings and also all the deals. But I decided that there were a lot of much more meaningful things that I did in these 20 years, and I'd like to take some time to share with you. 20 minutes will be enough. I have 5 slides, so I will be quick. The very first thing that I did when I went home as an econometrics student was to do youth work. I got myself into a position to do youth development work. And It's easy when you are doing all those positive youth development with all the young leaders, those who self-selected themselves, for example, who want to be leaders among the young people. But there's one particular group that I thought I should share with you. When I deal with the youth at risk, it was a great opportunity of self-discovery and self-learning. I discovered that, you know, when you talk to those who are at risk, that many times than not, a lot of them do not have the opportunity that some of us would consider as normal. When I talk to some of a young, we call them juvenile delinquents, who are caught for crime, after talking and getting to know them, their life is full of dismays and disappointment. They're never, even when they're going to school, they're never picked or selected for anything. Do you know that some of the young youth at risk, so to speak, that I have to deal with, many of them did not even know what a school camp is. They were never picked for going to a camp. So what I did was I put some of this idea together and started a very meaningful project. We call it the Streetwise Program. Even in Singapore, we have street gangs. We do have young street gangs. And when they commit a crime, it often go into the record book of, you know, that they have done something that they're not supposed to do, even as a young person. And it affects their whole career, their whole life. So I decided that I will push for a second chance program. And this program basically allows them to turn over a new leaf. And by, very simply, I bring them into a program to allow them to serve. Finally, they are selected to serve those who are even less privileged than them. And to cut the story short, in the whole learning process, I learned that actually every one of us has a way of trying to serve, or want to serve, a desire to serve. But if you do not unlock it, and you keep telling that person that you are useless, over time, that uselessness self-prophesies itself. And the whole philosophy of it being that the better one are also always being selected and chosen for the right thing in school, for the right thing in life, in career. Often than not, it only takes a little bit for us to create the opportunity for those who are falling below the nine to be given the uplift. And this is what I mean by sharing the benefit of growth. It's not about just making sure that everybody earns the highest income possible for each one of them. It is about giving some time, a life rope, to those who are just at the fringe. When I was in the Ministry of Finance in the early 2000s, those were the era that we would cut a lot of tax. I don't know if some of you will remember, but I was personally responsible for cutting income tax by almost over 10% within 2 or 3 years. In the same time, we were increasing GST, the goods and services tax. Then I discovered, actually, despite all that, despite trying to build a system that is sustainable, build a system that's fiscally sensible, a lot of time when we do spend many of our hard-earned taxpayer money, we are not targeted. In the early 2000s, if you go to a Singapore hospital, public hospital, even if you are come from a very rich family, you can choose to enjoy the same level of subsidies as a poor family. We wanted, in the name of universal coverage, to be available to all. But in that process, we could have done better because we could, by being more targeted, we could stretch the taxpayer money. So what I did was, as with my team, we introduced means testing. It's a simple idea. All of us learn in school. But how do you implement it? How do you implement it such that at the same time you are not telling the rich people that you no longer should enjoy subsidies? Today, if you go to the lowest class ward in our public hospital, you can be rich, you can be poor, but you will enjoy different level of subsidies according to your affordability, according to your income, according to how much you can afford. It is the same level of healthcare. It is the same doctor, it is the same nurses that will take care of you. For those of you who prefer to choose your doctor, you pay a higher price. For those who just want the system to provide you with a doctor, you pay a lower price. For those who decide to choose a class, lower class ward, but you are earning a high income, you pay a higher price compared to those who are earning a low income. Simple idea, but yet, you know, in its implementation, it can be very, very difficult. But with some perseverance, with some determination, if you believe in what you do believe in, and of course, at the end of the day, what you believe in must be sensible, it can be implemented. Quickly gone to the third area. This is an area that I fought 10 years of my life. For the last decade, even when I was just a small civil servant, I have been asking the government to give us money so that we can help the disabled in our system. You know, for such a rich country as we are in Singapore, often than not, we overlook some of these groups that are less privileged in the society. How do we help them? You know, in the previous system that we have, is because of Asian values, a lot of the Asian parents with disabled children would prefer to keep them away from public eyes. So a lot of time, you get to see them when they are in school. When they go to school, you know you have disabled classmates. When they finish schools, many of them do not have a means of making a living. They either do very little work or they stay at home. And the system sort of forgot about them. There's no way that the system tracked them. So, for example, we know that they are born or they along the way they become disabled. What sort of help should we be providing them once they finish school? Should we be also planning for them for the days where their parents will pass on? How do they look after themselves? So for the last 10 years, I have been championing together with a group of like-minded Singaporeans this idea of enabling the disabled. I'm happy to note that today I'm a board member of this new center called Center for Enabled Living, and we have received government funding. Today, we are able to track each one of them as long as they are disabled. Whether they need our help or not, it doesn't matter, but we would have help available for them. We would help them to plan their life ahead. And in a way, it's not a lot of money, but when you direct this little money to a very meaningful cause, it makes you feel that the society is not leaving you behind. I'm only about a year in Beijing. Previously, I was all in Tianjin. I have already discovered a lot of such issues. Even in a Chinese, recently I just adopted an orphanage for abandoned babies, helping them to raise money. If any one of you who are interested to find out what you can do to help me to get these 400 babies a better life, a chance to live, because very often in the Chinese society, when they are abandoned, actually they are already sick. And it's because, don't blame the parents all the time, it's because the parents may not be in the right financial position to help them. That's why they hand them over to the orphanage. I remember the earlier speaker who talked about casinos. I was also responsible for the two casinos. In fact, I was the chairman of the working committee that helped to set it up. In terms of personal value, I think here what I say, what I believe in and what I've been doing, you will say that, you know, you are practicing double standard. What are you talking about? And you have to create casinos with your hands. This is a job that we do, and as a professional in the civil service that we believe in. Actually, at the point of trying to create what we need to do, I'm really on this point trying to share with you that when you share benefits in a growth scenario, you also have to worry about whether you are sharing for the longer term. You could easily give up what you have now. Many of you will want to ask, how much do GIC have? I cannot tell you, of course, but many of you will want to ask. But that doesn't matter. I can assure you that if we distribute all to the Singaporeans, they all will become very rich. But for how long? And how long more will this nation last if we distribute all our money? Similar concept if you think about the Chinese context. In our case, we decided that our hollowing out of our manufacturing industry is inevitable and we've got to do something. I was part of the team that had to do the forecast. So Once you know you have to do something, you have to face the trade-off squarely. All of us know that if we build casinos, it comes with all types of things that you do not want, social problems. Rather than saying that we can all cope with a social problem, let me be very frank, when for the team that created, that tried to build up casino, we were confident only on one thing, which is we need the jobs. But whether how we will manage the social use and the social issues, it will be up to each one of us. There's no way you can eradicate illegal gambling, illegal money lending, and all the vices that seems to come with the casinos. But if we put our mind to it, and we all have the humility, I like the word, have the humility to let yourself know that you are not going to be overcoming anything, all this in a short term. We are put our mind to it and we can solve the problem. Today, you can say that we have a very world-class, very successful casino, but I can tell you the social problems are only at the beginning. It's something remain to be seen and require the determination of the social worker as well as the civil servant at work to bring through the whole system. So betting for a job. We lay these bets, we better face the trade-off. Last but not least, I had the privilege of transplanting myself altogether from Singapore. Singapore is very comfortable for those who had the chance of studying there and living in Singapore. And I went all the way to this second home in Tianjin, Binghai, New Area. I must tell you, I now is the first supporter of Tianjin, Binghai, New Area. The Tianjin mayor always called me to do economic promotion for Tianjin. I love this place because when I went there, it was very underdeveloped. Out there in Tianjin, Binghai, New Area, it's unimaginable. The day before I came to Tianjin, Binghai, New Area, I was in a very warm country, full of development, too many people. And when I went to Binghai, New Area on the very first day of work, they told me you cannot get to the work site. There's no road. And then we took trips to go to the work, finally the place that I'm supposed to help to develop. And it was all underwater because it's salt pans. And it's not, there's no land. I'm supposed to be developing land, but there is no land on the first day of work. I only spent 3 years of my life there, and I can tell you that when I walk off from the project 3 years later, it was a sense of pride. That is, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a fire burning within yourself. We managed to help Tianjin to bring in not just all the investment that you read about it, all the developers, all the investors, but more importantly, we created a place from scratch that will, in our view, be a real model for social and also for sustainable development. Take some time off. I know I don't have time. I can speak the whole day about EcoCity now, because in Tianjin, I found the possibility of creating an EcoCity from scratch. And China has a lot of such opportunity. And that is why I'm now very confident about China. Not because I did very well in Shanghai or Beijing or the big city, but because Tianjin, Binghai, New Area shows me that actually if you know how to put it, you lay the right foundation, you set the right standards, people will do the right thing. And it will be sustainable, it will be commercially viable. Let me not whitewash the whole process. It is a very tough process, and it will continue to be very tough. There will be a lot of approval that you need to seek. There will be a lot of quarrels that you need to have. Me, for example, I was deeply disappointed in the middle of my fear there when they decided that LRT will bypass the eco-city. How do you create an eco-sustainable city without the benefit of the light rail? So I fought very hard, and that's why the mayor is now my good friend. And we still continue to have LRT near to the eco-city. If you believe in eco, you must believe in the people, that the human spirit that will sustain itself. If you only talk about eco and sustainable development in terms of technology and sexy renewables, and you will never get there. You talk about how each resident of the future of the eco-city will live their life. and then you lay your cards and build a city from scratch. Actually, I have a lot more, but to be frank, I will end by one thing, self-reflection, because this is all about reflection. I'm speaking from my heart, and I'm not telling you what to do. But with, go back to the first point I make, with a good education, with a inspiring professors and a good environment, when you, what you equip with after the education is much more powerful than what you can think of. 20 years from now, you can share with another group about what you do. But you must remember, whether it's 20 or 30 or 40 years, what you do must not be about just for yourself. Ask yourself, whatever LSE has taught you or whatever other schools or universities have taught you, professors, have you used it and use it in a meaningful way? And then you can reflect about it like me. I'm still young. I'm looking forward to my next career. But I certainly hope that, you know, all of us can, in our small way, transform so that the benefits of growth will be shared in a much more wonderful, powerful way. Thank you.
Well, it is really a pleasure for me to be here to join this panel. And when I first received the invitation, I said no, because this is maybe the most of the have the background of economics, and I'm not. And people say, well, this is panel is for the managing the benefits of economic growth, and we really need a sociologist. I think this is why the reason I'm here. But to speak frankly, I have limited knowledge about the theories of development and the global, all the data of the accounting and et cetera. But I would like to take this chance and to call your attention to some social issues in China when the time and China is achieving significant economic growth. And I was told that because the majority of the audience is Chinese, so they asked me to speak in Chinese. At the end, I will take questions and answer them in English. How to page? How to turn the pages? Mm-hmm. Show me how to turn them. Okay. 所以呢，我下边呢就用中文来讲，因为呢，我刚才刚刚注意到了，我刚才看了我们这个 program， 好像我是唯一一个就是来自中国的，我觉得也很好啊。这个 LSE 在这儿开这个会的话，有一个中国人谈谈他的观点，我觉得也是一件好事。大家知道，中国的在这20多年里，中国的经济发展的非常的快啊，但是我们面临可能的问题就是。 那么我们这些财富应当如何来分配？如果当社会经济发展财富积累，如果分配的方法不当的话，如果我们的贫富差距拉得过大的话，如果我们的城乡差距拉得过大的话，如果我们的沿海的发达地区和西部的边疆地区的距离拉得过大的话，那么我们可能会面临比经济不发达。 更大的社会问题，所以呢，我要讲给大家提供几个其实可能大家都已经知道的数字，就是我们的经济发展的过程当中，政府的财政收入的增幅始终大于我们 GDP 的增幅。换句话说，政府是最大的经济发展的受益者，而这种情况在国外是不出现的。因为来说，应当大多数财富应当分配给老百姓，我们呢，政府全拿走，变成为所以我们的。 我们的三公支出它不可能降，因为它钱太多了，啊，而且我们的很多的各方面的支出，它也不可能在一个严格的监督之下来更有效的使用。比如拿2007年，我们 GDP 增长是114%，但财政收入增长132%，这个非常大的。 另外呢，我们会发现呢，在这个过程当中，城镇居民的收入呢，也比农村的居民收入呢，也是明显的高。在2000年的时候，这个是 2.8 倍，到了2010年的时候呢，就变成了3.2倍。所以我们看一看这个图，可以看到这个红线呢，就是我们的政府增长的税收，我们的下面这个蓝线呢是 GDP， 下面这两条线呢是城镇的居民收入跟农村的居民收入呢，这个实际上我们看到这个距离实际上是在不断在扩大。另外一个呢，我们说虽然城镇居民的收入在提高，但是城民众的消费和商品服务的购买力还是很有限的。所以这一面呢，就是说一方面人民收入在提高，但是呢我们并没有真正形成国内的市场，就是购买力没上来。那么为什么？因为我们在改革发展同时呢，我们实际上是把住房、教育和医疗呢推行了产业化，这个本来在很大程度上应当属于公共服务的领域，最后变成了一个 business， 变成一个 money making institutions。 所以这样的话就造成了一个使这样的一些机构变成了一个最大的盈利机构，同时呢也使我们分配不公的情况越来越恶化。很多人钱不敢花，为什么？他怕生病，他要供孩子上大学，他要买房子。所以这样一种社会的两极分化呢，导致底层社会的普遍不满情绪。为什么这些年的群众性事件越来越多？为什么在征地上、在强拆、在一些包括一些像富士康的跳楼自杀很多的问题？其实我觉得这些年来，在我们的高楼大厦这种表面的繁华的同时，其实大家应该注意到我们底层社会的矛盾正在不断的积累。所以我们的维稳费当然要高出我们的军费，我们的一个城市一个地方的安全部门可能有几上万人。另外一个我特别要指出来说，因为在座的可能都是来自于大城市或者我们中央的各个部委，对西部地区呢不是非常的熟悉。我大概这20年呢一直长期在西藏、新疆、青海、内蒙这个地方呢来做调查，也写了很多相关的专业调研报告。所以我觉得实际上我们应当在我们的发展过程当中要关注一下西部。在2000年中央实施了西部大开发的发展战略，这个目的呢我觉得很清楚。第一个呢，我们需要能源，新疆有石油天然气，内蒙有石油有煤炭。另外呢，在发展的同时，我们希望改变东西方在社会经济发展水平上的差距。我们在这30年来应当说东西部的差距是在急剧在扩大。我们在其实在改革开放之前，西部的收入是比东部要高的，因为我们当时是八级工资制。而现在随着沿海的发展，整个的这个市场经济的发展呢，西部的收入明显的在减少。另外的话呢，中央也希望通过西部基础设施的投资、交通运输、水利、通讯能够拉动产值和就业。另外就是准备就是重开这个丝绸之路，开拓中亚和南亚的市场。不同的单位提供了不同的数字，有人说6万亿，有人说4万亿，有人说不少，是吧？总的来说是我们在当地的发展的来看，其实这些地方的经济活力并没有真正的能够得到建设。我们发现绝大多数的建设项目其实不是由当地的公司和劳动力来完成的，还是来自于中央企业和沿海企业的承建。所以变成什么情况，就是说在乌鲁木齐买当地新疆生产的天然气比运到了上海，比上海市民买的还要贵。而且当地的我们在南疆的调查的石油企业的公司，那公司的来自内地的产煤的产油就是油田操作工呢，每月工资是超过一万的时候，当地的普通工人工资大概就500。这是一个就是我们整个的就是我们西部地区当地的民众和企业并没有真正的参与西部大开发，也没有真正分享到这种开发所得来的利益。与此同时，在这些项目进行推动的时候呢，有大量内地的这汉族流动人口呢也来到了西部。所以我们根据最近的人口普查资料，在西藏的汉族人口呢从原来的2% 现在大概到了 8%， 这个数字是绝对数字是翻得很大。另外就这样就使得当地的少数民族企业和劳动力明显的边缘化，而且一些企业来自于内地沿海的企业，对吧，它往往是一个非常简单的一个牟利，所以它对于当地的环境的污染，而当地环境污染的监控条件手段也不是很强，所以带来当地的 一系列的环境的问题。而且由于来自沿海的这些汉族的农民工、这些企业家、这些工人，他在语言和宗教上和西部地区差别很大，在西藏藏传佛教，在新疆是伊斯兰教，所以他的文化的摩擦冲突也不断在加强。大家可能知道，这个实际上最近一直问题比较多，这个西藏的这个自焚那个到45个，这个新疆的这种恐怖事件大概每个月都没有断过。另外呢，我记得我们长期以来，原来我们那个北大的一个老所长傅晓彤先生一直强调，就说民族地区的发展不等于当地少数民族的发展，因为这些地方的 GDP 它的产值可能不是由当地的老百姓创造的，而是由汉人或者是来自于外地的去创造的。所以我们说民族地区的 GDP 不能等于少数民族的发展的一个指标。所以我们从这个图上来看的话，我们说当产业分布的话，你会发现当地的蒙古族、本地的蒙古族比这个地区的这个从事于第一产业的呢是远远是高的，非常明显的是高的。你会发现比如说像新疆的话，整个新疆的第一产业劳动力只占60%的时候，维吾尔族占80%。大家知道在目前的情况下，这种粗放的农业的农民的收入是明显比较低的，换句话说这样一个高比例的农业的人口就导致了维吾尔族的整体的收入是明显低于当地的这个汉族。而且这种情况到了2010年甚至并没有改善。到2010年的时候呢，当新疆的农业人口占61%的时候呢，维吾尔族比例反而增加了，从80%增加了82%。换句话说这10年我们看到它是更一步边缘化。另外我们说同时看我们的行业分布也非常的清楚，全国现在在2000年的时候是64%，到了2010年是48%，但是藏族的第一产业农民无论是2000年还是2010年呢，你发现比例都是高在80%以上。所以我们在全国来说，我们是实际上是制造业服务业的明显发展，但是我们在边疆地区特别当地的主要少数民族，那藏族和维吾尔族来说呢，他们实际上并没有真正进入这样一个改型。我们再看一看职业，就我们说一方面我们看 industrial distribution， 我们看一看 occupation distribution， 你会发现实际上我们说如果在讲他的这个社会的地位和他的话语权是吧的这时候，你会发现实际上呢，我们就说在所有的劳动力的15岁以上当中呢，作为单位企业负责人的比例汉族在增加，作为专业 professional 也在增加，但是你会发现蒙古族、藏族、回族、维吾尔族呢却在大幅度的降低。在所有的维吾尔族15岁以上的劳动当中，作为负责人从0.8%变成了0.4%。所以呢你会发现西部大开发投资几万亿，产值发展得很快，城镇化也在发展，但是当地本地的少数民族的无论在行业上还是在职业上实际上都是在面临一个边缘化的问题。也正是这样的一个边缘化才导致这些地方的一些民族问题和它的社会的不稳定。我们谈到分配，我们谈到 managing the benefits of economic growth， 我们必须要从这样一些角度来看这样一些问题。我们看到比如说工人，像维吾尔族它在制造业的生产的这样的一个比例呢，从5.8%降到了4.5%，这个态势是非常的清楚的啊，这个是清楚的。所以说我们谈到中国经济发展很快，大家都为我们的城市的建设啊，这个高楼大厦，我们的制造业，我们方面的发展，我们都非常的觉得是很惊奇。但是我觉得我们中国经济的发展和财富的分配必须充分的考虑到农村的居民和我们西部地区过去发展相对之后的这样的少数民族的民众，所以打破城乡二元壁垒的是刻不容缓。我们不能再继续允许 城市和农村居民的收入在继续的保持着一半一半这样一个这样的一种可能。另外呢，东部沿海地区的和西部边疆地区的社会经济发展和公共服务的水平必须逐步的取得了平衡。如果在现代化的过程当中，少数民族被不断的边缘化，那必然会损害民族团结、社会和谐和国家的统一。我们要保持在21世纪我们面临着激烈的国际竞争，是吧？我面临着欧洲、日本、美国、印度、俄罗斯，我们周边有很多它的经济实体呢，彼此都在进行激烈竞争。在这过程当中，我们必须维持国家统一，维持民族团结。如果我们不能够保持政治一体的国家格局，同时尊重少数民族的文化遗产和文化多样性，而把它看作是宝贵的中华文化遗产，坚持平等共同繁荣的话呢，那么实际上呢，我们的 GDP 发展的再快，我们的财富积累再多，但是我们这个社会面临的风险也就越大。好，谢谢。
Thank you very much, Mr. Goh and Professor Marong, for your separate individual insights into this problem of managing the benefits of economic growth. We have time for some questions, and just as before, if people who are asking questions could wait until the microphone gets to you, and if you wish, please do identify yourself if you think that that will typically help us direct the answer to the question. So the gentleman over here first, yes, and then up in front, coming up in front. So gentleman there first, where you are right now. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
Taibun, I have a question for you. I was probably of the same vintage as you at LSE, but I studied law. Recently in Singapore, there were so many cases of very high-profile civil servants. I mean, Singapore, as you mentioned rightly, is a very prosperous city with world-class universities, world-class hospitals. But why is there a sudden moral decay? What are the social factors that resulted in so many high-profile civil servants, church leaders, and other leaders of society engaging in corruptions, improprieties? Is there a sudden moral decay, or is it due to law, better law enforcement? What are the reasons?
Well, you know, I was hoping for a more economic question. So, are you really happy? I mean, it's really correct to ask that question. I think I would turn it around by asking the same question in another way. You know, to be very frank, the fact that there are certain cases that's becoming more and more going to our courts and you hear about them, you know, does it really reflect the Singaporeans' public as a whole? And the fact that you mentioned that one very key point that we keep hearing about it, why are these top civil servants, these top leaders, why are they doing all this improper behavior? I think I can only give you that because I even though I was in their position before, I have never ever maintained that I'm a top civil servant. As far as a society, a community of people is concerned, everyone has his rightful role and rightful contribution in that community. How they go wrong, every case will be individually driven. I don't think you should generalize that Singaporeans are actually morally very bad now. Everybody suddenly are going to seek prostitution and just because of these cases. In every society, you are bound to have a bunch of such people. If they are overrepresented in that era, they will be eradicated. You know, over time, I believe that goodness will prevail. And if you, at the end of it, the answer for you is actually for yourself. Whether when you do those things, you are put in position to do those things, are you doing it with the right intention? I can't really answer your question because each some of them are actually my friend. Hmm. For those who are my friends, it's a question that I'll ask them individually because I wouldn't generalize that why you as a group are like that. Because the story, the answers will go forever. Individually, they must be, if they are my friends, they must be able to account for themselves to me. I think I will leave it as that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Goh. The gentleman in the black shirt, he's got his hand up, and then I'll pick you up afterwards.
Thank you very much for your enlightening speeches. My name is Christian Jung, and I studied urban planning at the LSE around 7 years ago. There has been a lot of talk tonight about growth, and what was somehow missing from the debate, I found, was sustainability. And growth largely depends on resources, and those resources, as we know, are very limited. And I'm wondering if there's any discussion at the LSE and in China, what can actually be done for equality and for managing the benefits if there is no growth? Can there actually be redistribution? Can the poorer people keep their wealth or even improve their wealth when the pie doesn't grow anymore? And would that not be something which would allow China not to rely on those notorious 8% anymore?
Thank you. I think, Professor Ma Rong, could you begin the answer to that question?
Well, I think you raised a very important point. And at the very beginning, you know, after the reform, and we are so eager to achieve the economic growth, so pay less attention to the environment protection and sustainability. But in the past, we have so many things happens. You can know in the lot of protections in the different cities against the pollution and shut down some factories. I think more and more people are recognized. So this is so important to protect the environment. I think when people have the knowledge, have the way to speak out, I think they will find a way to solve the problem. But anyway, so in the, I think the more concern about the minorities. So in the Tibetan, in the Mongolia and the Uyghurs, actually they have less knowledge about pollution. And sometimes they have they don't speak fluent Mandarin language. So sometimes their benefits, their concern are not really heard by the mainstream. So that'd be a big issue. That's why, you know, in the past several years, and in the Tibet, also in Mongolia, I think the March 11 last year was demonstration in the, the Western Ujimuchin banner about the miners, some problems over there. Yes, I guess gradually, and the sustainability and the environmental protection has attained more and more attention of the people and also the authority. I think we will pay more attention to this field in the later.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Goh, would you like to share some of your experiences with the work on Tianjin Eco-City in particular?
Yeah. The word sustainable development, sustainability, are often used in a marketing way when you read about it. Today, we know technology, we know solution, we know companies who are out there because they think that there are a lot of money to be made. I happen to start a new city from scratch that's meant to be sustainable in the full sense of the word. We have 26 indicators to measure our results technically. But whatever you can do technically by measure in numbers, set standards, ultimately, there are two very important points in my view after spending so much time trying to build this city. One is clearly governance. You can have the best standards, you can build the best things, but do you have the governance standards, the people who are willing to preserve what is built and continue what the standards and the path that we have set them on. Certainly, from my experience in Tianjin Eco-City, it cannot be dictated by a Singaporean or a group of Singaporeans. It will be the people that we are building for who eventually have to set their own standards. And secondly, I think human nature is such that if you build something that is good for them, ultimately there will be the instinct to protect it and want to sustain it. If you force feed them with something that is unnatural, that is not part of them, not part of their lifestyle, and not even, you know, of their choice, I think it will be a very difficult process. And today, I think the wonderful thing about Chinese and China is that you have a lot of choices. Imagine if we were in facing all this problem 20 years ago when your economy was not as strong as it is today. You cannot afford to make those choices. Then you will take a very difficult path. Today, you have so much at stake, but yet you have so much available to you. And this is the moment that wrong decision will lead you to the wrong path as well. But this is a moment where the right leadership, the right governance, and the people who desire to build a strong and nice homeland will go the right way. We all remember the period living in Beijing during the Olympic 4 years ago. If you can see blue sky for such a prolonged period of time, and you ask yourself whether you want to live in a place where blue sky is a norm. I can tell you, even Beijing, I was here then, because of that possibility, you want to find out how you can play a part to build that future, that so that it will be sustainable. And I think this will have to be from the grassroots. No policy, no incentive is going to force the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The gentleman up in front.
Hello, I'm a local undergraduate, and I hope I'm to be in LC next year. So my question is for Professor Ma about the Mandarin language. I come from Aba, Tibetan and Chang Auto Prefecture, and myself, I'm an ethnic minority. And my question is that, just as you mentioned in your presentation about the workforce in the different industries, the problem is that I think to gain my intellectual capital, it's necessary to have a good knowledge in Mandarin. And as you said, it's also very important to maintain the traditional culture of the ethnic minority. But I think it's very difficult to balance the two. And I want to know how do you think about, because as when I was very young, my grandparents and my parents say to me that don't use your time to learn the traditional language to improve your Mandarin, to improve your English, to get a better job. And now I find it's very pity that I almost lose my traditional culture. But I'm now in Beijing, and I think my life is also very good. So I just want to know, how do you think of the problem? Thank you.
Well, in the past 10 years, it's almost past 10 years, and there's a very hot issue in debate. And that's a bilingual education. So as a multi-ethnic nation, on one side, we should be very carefully preserved and develop the minority languages and the culture, traditional cultures. Other side, because we have the economic growth, you know, that you have a national economic system and the markets, in job market. So to be master of the Mandarin language, it's a basic skill. It's required. We don't can speak Mandarin. It's so difficult to find a job. So we have to keep the two sides in balance. I think sometimes local government, like in Xinjiang, they move forward too fast. We have called another great leap forward and make people are very, you know, disturbed, are very unhappy. They need to consider to protect their traditional, their motherland, the mother languages. But so we will have to keep it in balance. I think you will really, based on the field, you know, the systematically nice research, we find all the conditions people demand, we carefully design the teaching program. I said we can solve the problem, keep them both sides in balance.
We cannot allow, you see, the Tibetan language, Uyghur language disappear, because it's also part of the Chinese culture as a whole. As it's also the, called the cultural diversity must be preserved. So your question is also raised by many, you know, people from the minority groups, and they're very concerned about. I think it's very important, and I think the government is also trying to work it out how to keep the two sides concerned in balance.
Thank you. Let me take questions from this side of the room now. We've heard a lot from the crowded East Coast manufacturing parts of China. So in the interest of regional balance, can we have some questions from this side? First this side, and then I'll get people in the middle. So the two gentlemen in the back.
Hi, Charlie Wong. I studied accounting and finance at LSE. My question is having to do with what I'll call institutionalized inequality. Right, and what I mean is where, let's say, for example, in the West, those who create policy are the ones who benefit from policy, right? And the strong become stronger and wealthier, and perhaps something like that happens here in China as well. So how does a society address this institutional inequality issue? Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Ma Rong, do you want to begin, and then Mr. Goh?
Well, I think for the policy designer, I think there are all issues is in discussion. But in the real practice, I think there's still a lot of things did not reach the agreement, I guess. And for the institution, you know, in the Western society, it's more mature of the civil society. The non-government organizations play important roles. But in China, we see there's still a lot of limitations. And I think the society is trying to build up more stronger institutions and discuss all the policy issues and try to make the society become more diversified. And all the people from different segmentations of society can participate, can speak out, can contribute, and try to make the effort to change the society. I don't know whether I answered your question.
Mr. Goh, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, I don't really know in my own experience how I can answer the question. But, you know, in Singapore, maybe from reflecting about the small Singapore example, you tend to think that there is, you know, commonly known that we have very strong institutions and organization, especially the public sector and organs of the state. It's also important to know that they are often than not, a key question is whether it's best done by institutions. A lot of time when I identify a social issue or social problem, it's actually better not to bring it to a de facto institution who has been looking at a problem and not solving. In my own opinion, in some area, it's better to start on your own, find the right like-minded people, and connect over ideas and conviction, persuade people, and then you can find simple local solutions that overcome simple local problems, rather than bring it into a national level and give it to that scale that is unsolvable. And when you solve it, there will be a lot of unhappy people because they did not benefit from your solution. That's my own take. And so what you see you can solve, you should solve yourself. And never always think that there's some institution there that we should either build or go to. Even Singaporeans like me feel it this way. If the government keep doing and solving every solution, what do we exist for? Just to pay tax? If you see something is not right, what do you do? I think that is the key.
Thank you. Okay, I've been told that I need to wind this down, and it's great to see so much enthusiasm and interest from you. In the interest of having as many people speak as possible, could I ask if you want to ask the next question, keep it very short, keep it very directed. I'm going to take a question in groups of three. So the gentleman in front here, just a very short, directed question, please.
Thank you. A specific question for Senior VP of GIC.
I was told that GIC tends to achieve an investment return rate higher than global inflationary rate over a period of over 20 years. Is it true? And I know that you're also responsible to manage and maintain, increase the value of...
Okay, can we keep the question to, is it true?
Okay, sure. Of Singapore's foreign exchange reserve. The question is, what is the risk appetite allowed to GIC by the Singapore government? Thank you.
You might have to say no comment, but we'll have to take a couple more questions. The woman, lady in front, and then over there.
I have a question for Professor Quach. You just mentioned that in the United States, the top 1% of the population possess 90% of the society's wealth. And I think this phenomenon is not does not happen only in the United States, but in a lot of other countries too, like China or India. My question is, how do the top 1% of the population happen to possess the 95% of the society's wealth? And because I read in a book, Poor Rich Dad and Poor Dad, his answer to his question is financial intelligence of the top 1%. And how do you, what's your opinion?
Okay, thank you. I'll add that question to the group that we might all answer. And then finally, the woman in back, in second row, and then we're going to have to finish.
我想问马荣教授一个问题，就是您提到政府的宏观政策其实在西部开发中有一些偏颇的地方，那我想问一下，就是在政府本身执政党的这个意识形态和西部当地的这些宗教之间有多少弹性？因为之前我也了解到，如果是西部本地人口他要进入中央当地的主要权力中心的话，他需要声明自己是共产主义者、无神论者。那您认为这中间有多少弹性？然后另外我还想问一下，就是您怎么评价在西部大开发中间，然后以及少数民族的这个各方面问题解决中间的时间表和顺序问题，就是经济发展、环境发展以及当地文化发展之间的顺序问题？
好，谢谢。Okay, Professor Maro, if you could pick up on that last question first, and then we'll go down the list.
Well, I think you see, and you're right. You see, generally the government employees are not allowed to go to the Muslim mosques, not to the for the worship. So this is because you have to follow the civil society, right? But you see that still so many young people try to be the government employees. And actually, in the private time, it's no problem. So that's not, you see, all the policy did not really block, you see, the minorities become the government officers and join the army and also become, the government, for the top level. So I think that is not the problem. But some kind of policies really control the mosque size and also the monk size of the monasteries in Tibet in those areas have some problem because a lot of people want to be monks. So there's some limitations here in Tibet, also in Xinjiang. Mm-hmm. I think policies have problem with the Normans, with the farmers, but for the university graduates, and I think that it's not a big issue, that's the first thing. And the second, you see the government policies. Well, I think there's some problem in the policy designing. For example, we have the program, you see the aid in peer, 对口支援, right? So the Zhejiang, for example, have a 6 per thousand of income must donate to the Xinjiang, right? If this is its quota, they must follow that. So this is very easy for central government to set up its order. But for the rational strategy of the Zhejiang province, they prefer to give all the money in the infrastructure project constructions. And all of those majority of projects actually was taken by Zhejiang enterprises. Mm. So by this way,
they turn out to be the Zhejiang GDP, Zhejiang tax, Zhejiang employment opportunities. So by this, we actually didn't help Xinjiang much. So, but the government simply, we have a good purpose, is everything designed, it's great. But also there's a build, there's a building, there's a highways, it's finished. But actually, there's still cause a lot of problems. So that's why I think that there's a need a lot of field research to see to, on one side, we still say, well, the government is a purpose trying to help to develop. But on the other side, there are a lot of problems, you know, in the designing. I think the, for the all scales, plans, the problems over there. And also you need for the all the enterprises, their purpose to go Xinjiang is to make money, short term. You know, they, therefore the office, all the CEOs, the term is 4 years, 5 years, they do not care what's happening 10 years or 20 years after. So that's why the short term money making strategy lead them to ignore the environmental issues that cause a problem. And local government have a limit of quite weak voice trying to against that. This is a problem.
Thank you. Mr. Goh, can you speak to GIC's required rate of return and risk appetite, or would you speak to some other question?
I thought I'd just quickly answer the GIC question.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I think obviously he already know a lot about GIC. So if you want to find out more, you can go onto our website to... Just remember, key to the answer to your question is this. We are, if many people think that we are just fund manager, but remember, I'm managing my own money. If you are managing your own money, ultimately, how will you behave? And that is the best way to describe GIC. We are Singaporeans managing Singapore money. It's just like you manage your own money. How will you invest? Will you invest in what sort of high-risk products? Or would you make sure that whatever you do at the end of the day, you will get, still have something, and you will be able to grow your pie for the future, not just one.
Thank you. I guess it's my job to pick up on the last question here. Thank you very much for that. It is true that inequality is high and has been growing throughout many different countries in the world with many different social systems. The point of my example was not to either blame or finger the United States, but also to keep us from thinking that inequality and rising inequality deprivation happens only in our own societies. It happens everywhere. It happens whether, you know, if you're standing here, the United States must look bad, but if you're standing in the United States, the rest of the world might look pretty bad too. On the factual point, while that number is high in the United States, inequality is different across countries. It is higher in some countries than in others. And why that happens is for a whole range of different reasons that I hope I'm happy to talk about afterwards. But I think it's appropriate at this point to thank all of you here for your attention and to invite you to thank the panelists alongside me for a very entertaining and informative panel discussion. Thank you very much. I invite Professor Stuart Cobridge up to the stage.
Thank you, Danny. I won't keep you. It's just a great pleasure on behalf of LSE to bring this conference to a conclusion with one or two votes of thanks as well. We've run late. We always run late. That's not because of bad organisation. We've had fantastic organisation from Brendan Smith, from his colleagues at the LSE, and from the student volunteers. We've run late, of course, because we've had a high-quality discussion. I particularly want to thank our panellists, particularly when they've come from Singapore or from PKU, or our distinguished guest speaker, Chairman Jin. My colleagues from LSE, I thank them. They have to get up early tomorrow to teach at Beida, and some of them are wanting to get to their beds, no doubt, fairly soon. Most of all, I'd like to thank all of you for staying engaged with the conference, particularly if you are students at the LSE, alumni at the LSE, and the only other category remaining, I hope, is friends of the LSE. Please do stay in touch with your school and have a safe journey home. Thank you very much.